Ausschuss über die Fusion und gar nicht aufstellen würden können. Vor allem aber, sie kämpfen immer am gleichen Platz. Hier und da soll es dann bescheiden, nach 14 Tagen, sie haben eine Stadt evakuiert. Aber im Allgemeinen kämpfen sie seit dem 22. Juni am gleichen Platz immer erfolgreich. Immer werden wir zurückgeschlagen und sind bei diesem fortgesetzten Zurückschlag im ganzen System auf.
Haven't attacked you, and for you to come on and use those sort of insults me. Thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate that.
Okay.
Much
well,
more news ahead on it. Cut the mic, please.
Soll es auch wir treu sein? Adolf Hitler, der Führer der deutschen Jugend, hat das Wort.
Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor fracturing her ankle. Now the question is, would a white male judge have fractured his ankle? I hope she can find a wise Latina doctor.
She clearly supported racial quotas for clearly racial quota reasons. What she said was racist.
I want to talk about the news business.
I am not a citizen of the world. I think the entire concept is intellectual nonsense.
While other presidents, from Reagan to Kennedy, have said the same thing.
I speak today as both a citizen of the United States and of the world.
Was Ronald Reagan engaging in intellectual nonsense?
On Sunday, the San Francisco Chronicle printed that I call George Tiller Dr. Killer. In Dr. Killer's case, that's a lie.
Shep Smith, Fox News. Here, play audio soundbite number 9.
The email, to me, has become more and more frightening. And they are out there. I mean, out there in a scary place.
For liberals to now claim that the atmosphere is somehow more violently anti-Obama is simply preposterous. Barack Obama failing to implement all this equals America surviving.
Massive third world chip on his shoulder.
Authoritarian with a God complex.
Headed towards socialism.
This is empathetic fascism that's coming our way. At first it's done through, let's do the right thing. Then it's done through fear. Then it's done through bribery. At some point you have to take a gun, don't you?
There has been a shooting inside the Holocaust Museum there in Washington, D.C.
Meanwhile, the Department of Homeland Security reports about right-wing extremists. Remember that came out a few weeks ago?
Janet Napolitano, the Homeland Security Secretary.
Take a lot of heat after a warning that there could be an uptick, if you will, in violence from white supremacist groups and others.
They see signs that this sort of thing is bubbling up. It was a warning to us all, and it appears now that they were right.
Now you've got this absolutely screaming nutcase right-winger.
This is not the work of right-wing conservatives.
And we have an administration that's really done a lot of class warfare, a lot of class baiting. And so it sets the stage for social unrest.
It is they who are fomenting racial and religious tension in this country. The left in this country is creating a very dangerous climate, and they're doing it on purpose. This president thrives and needs chaos and unrest.
I'm not stirring the pot. I am pointing out that the pot is boiling and there is trouble in America. There is going to be a witch hunt, I believe, in this country and quite possibly all around the world.
Are they being motivated to move by right-wing pronouncements like he's dangerous? He's a socialist, he's a Muslim, and he isn't even a U.S. citizen.
Vigilante and militia-style rhetoric has become a cornerstone of the movement and certainly of conservative media. And there are consequences and responsibilities when you sort of broadcast that hate 24/7.
This guy is a leftist.
Was the alleged shooter a man of the left?
Look at some of the causes that James R. Bruin has associated himself with. One is the conspiracy theory that Barack Obama was not born an American citizen, therefore he can't be president.
In Kenya, where, of course, our president was born.
God does not have a birth certificate, neither does Obama.
He's anti-immigration.
How many illegal aliens can you get into a Ford Excursion? Apparently about 27. And you can actually roll that Ford Excursion on a back road of Arizona and only kill 10 of them.
Now, this is a very important story. The Bremerhaven Zoo in Bremen, Germany, has imported four female penguins from Sweden who are supposedly, allegedly gay. I can't figure out how they know the penguins are gay. How would you come to that conclusion? Do they wear tight T-shirts? I mean, what how do you know? I don't know.
Adolf Hitler, der Führer der deutschen Jugend, hat das Wort.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Poor people gonna rise up, take what's there. It's finally the tables are starting to turn. Talk about a revolution.
This week in radical history, for the week starting June 22nd. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and lots of radical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the east side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
As always, we're gently lifting some audio from the Columbus Neighborhood Network of Columbus, Ohio, and audio from the Radio Roots crew from WBAI in New York, which you're about to hear right now.
On this day, June 22nd, in 1898, the first wave of U.S. troops landed at Daiquiri, Cuba, preparing to invade the Spanish colony. The U.S. and Spain were in the middle of the Spanish-American War. The Cuban Revolutionary Forces, who were in the middle of fighting for independence from Spain, helped the U.S. Marines when they arrived. Although the U.S. had promised to leave control of the island to its people after Spain was defeated, when the Spanish surrendered at the end of the year, an arrangement was made giving America many of Spain's territories, including Cuba. That the U.S. would go back on its word is not surprising, considering their interest in gaining control of Cuba before they offered their help. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on June 22nd, last year, a man I would easily call a comrade, George Carlin, dies. Here's a little audio of his politic.
Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, George, I voted. The limits of debate in this country are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized. They're made to seem either to be communists or some sort of disloyal person. A kook, there's a word, and now it's conspiracy. See, they've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. So the only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only answer.
This week in radical history, starting June 23rd, 1683, William Penn signs a friendship treaty with Lenni Lenape Indians in Pennsylvania. It is the first treaty signed in the new U.S. of A. Lenni would later help supply the Revolutionary Army with scouts and supplies for a significant future role in self-governance of their tribal members. Of course, this would be only one of a long list of promises and treaties the good old U.S. of A. would break with all Native Americans they come across. On June 23, 1848, in France, Paris Uprising. Hot on the heels of Prague, Paris burns in what is known as the June Days Workers' Uprising. Also on June 23, 1924, in Spalding County, Georgia, Marcus and Penny Westmoreland, a black man and woman, are lynched for being argumentative. Also on this date, 1925, in China, British warships fire on Hong Kong Harbor strikers. British and French soldiers machine gun Chinese demonstrators in Canton fighting against colonialization. Also on June 23, 1937, in Spain, following the communist suppression of the anarchists and members of the Lincoln Brigade fighting the fascists in Spain, George Orwell flees with his wife. He would later write a book about his experiences called Homage to Catalonia, about the anarchist struggle in Spain, as well as his experiences being shot fighting the fascists and the counter-revolutionary Stalin forces. Again, that book is Homage to Catalonia by George Orwell. Also on that date, 1964, U.S., a burning station wagon is found belonging to the Freedom Riders, Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner, murdered by the KKK near Philadelphia, Mississippi. Also on that date, 1966, month-long race riots begin in Cleveland, Ohio. Also on June 23, 1967, battle with 10,000 anti-war protesters greeting the president at a Los Angeles speech. Also on that date, 1970, in Japan, seeing what the U.S. does to other places in Asia like Vietnam, Japanese protest against a new U.S.-Japanese defense treaty. More than 750,000 take to the streets in numerous cities across Japan. Also on that date, 1971, Louis Leecoin dies. French anti-militant anarchist, seeing the world as it is, he once wrote, "One does not create human society on mounds of corpses." Also on June 23, 1972, media always being very late to the game as Life magazine publishes photos of South Vietnamese children running from U.S. carpet bombing with the chemical weapon napalm. Also on that date, 1994, the U.N. says about 20,000 Muslim women have been raped in 3 years of the fighting in the ex-Yugoslavia. The United States, not wanting to get involved, closes its eyes to the atrocities occurring in the former Yugoslavia. As noted in George Orwell's book, Animal Farm, unpopular ideas can be silenced and inconvenient facts kept in the dark without a need for any official banning. This week in Radical History for June 24th, 1633, the Catholic Inquisition finally releases the scientist Galileo for daring to claim that Earth is not the center of the universe. What heresy. Also on June 24th, 1848, Albert Parsons born in Alabama, one of the many anarchists unjustly accused and executed for the Haymarket bombing in Chicago. Again, national and international protests. However, the Illinois Supreme Court rejects their appeal. Playwright George Bernard Shaw would write, "If the world must lose eight of its people, it could be better afford to lose the eight members of the Illinois Supreme Court." Also on June 24, 1901, Pablo Picasso's first exhibition in Paris. In his youthful formative years, Picasso was politically linked with the international anarchist movement. French police kept them under surveillance for nearly 40 years, and when a Spanish-born painter applied for citizenship, the authorities could not decide whether he was an anarchist or a communist, so they ruled that he is undesirable just in case. Also on June 24, 1904, Colorado, troops arrest 22 workers, labeling them as strike leaders and troublemakers, and deport them via a train out of the area. In March of the same year, another 60 union members were deported and told never to come back. After 3 more months of hardship, the union was eventually broken. The police always have been and always will be an arm of the aristocracy. Also on June 24, 1919, following an attack on the house of the Attorney General Palmer on June 2nd, the Palmer raids begin as anarchists and 7 collaborators are expelled from the land of the free. Also on June 24, 1968, pre-Petraeus propaganda is announced as General Wheeler, Chief of Staff, U.S. Army, assures the New York audience that the enemy has lost whatever chance it has of taking South Vietnam by military force. Eerie sounds of Iraq of today. On this day in Radical History for June 25th, in a land built on religious freedoms from persecution in 1594, Margaret Frey and Agatha Byronsag are burned as witches. Also on June 25th, 1876, Lakota, Cheyenne, and Apache tribes defeat the U.S. Army in Little Bighorn. Resisting the authority of the U.S. government efforts to herd them into reservations, also known as internment camps. Gee, after all we've done for them. Also on June 25, 1878, despite mass protest, Ezra Haywood gets 2 years of hard labor for advocating free love, sexual emancipation as part of the women's rights movement. I guess what's good for the goose isn't good for the gander.
On this day, June 25th in 1910, Congress passed the Mann Act, or the White Slave Traffic Act, prohibiting interstate or international transportation of women for immoral purposes. The legislation was intended to protect white women from being forced into prostitution or sex slavery, and was a xenophobic response to the increasing number of immigrant men in America, particularly from China. The law was also broadly worded and was often manipulated to criminalize consensual sexual activity and perpetuate the idea that women were property. Unfortunately, forced sexual exploitation still exists all over the world, and the sex trafficking of women and children has been steadily increasing with the rise of globalization.
Also on June 25, 1950, Korea War begins with North Korea communist forces crossing the 38th parallel. This was not the first time the U.S. was in Korea. Even though there was no commies to fight back then, way back in 1887, the U.S. invaded Korea to protect American interests. That was first invasion in 1887, very much pre-communist era. Also on that date, 1973, John Dean, before the Senate Watergate Committee, testifies in 4 days, indicting himself, Nixon, Ulrichman, Mitchell, and others while revealing the use of hush money and an enemies list. Now if we can only get Cheney and Gonzalez to open up. Same crimes, different time. This week in Radical History for June 26, 1886 in France. Charles Gallo, hauled to court and sentenced for his attack of March 5th on the stock exchange, is expelled from the courtroom shouting, "Death to the bourgeois judges! Long live dynamite! Long live anarchy!" He receives 20 years for all those outbursts. Also on June 26, 1893, imprisoned Haymarker anarchist not already hung by the state of Illinois is pardoned by the Illinois governor. The show trial and convictions were a travesty. Eight would die too late for the governor's pardon. Also on June 26, 1917, the first U.S. troops enter Europe on this day to fight the war to end all wars. Oops, got that war to end all wars thing wrong, I guess.
On this day, June 26, 1918, Eugene Debs, labor activist and leader of the U.S. Socialist Party, was arrested under the Espionage Act for an anti-war speech he delivered in Canton, Ohio. Debs often criticized the American military system, and in this particular speech, he explained that America's interest in World War I was fueled by capitalism. He also highlighted the irony of America's claim to be protecting democracy abroad and encouraged Americans to resist the draft. While still imprisoned at the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, Debs ran for president in the 1920 election as a Socialist Party candidate. His experience in prison also inspired him to write a series of articles criticizing the prison industrial complex.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, and welcome to another edition of This Week in Palestine, which features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, that is rarely reflected in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This morning we feature a discussion with Niam Atik, a Palestinian Episcopal priest and director of the Sabil Ecumenical Liberation Theology Center in Jerusalem, and journalist and author Max Blumenthal, along with Tariq Abwata of Friends of Sabil North America. This is a presentation of the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center. We begin with opening words from the moderator, Max Blumenthal.
I guess I'm the moderator. Welcome. I always, I guess we should just get right into it. I mean, great timing or bad, terrible timing for your tour, but it's certainly momentous.
Well, it's not only bad days. They are sad days. It's tragic days for our people and for all of our friends who have been working for a just peace for many, many years, you know. So, but, you know, I feel it's not the end of Jerusalem in that sense. I don't think it is the President of the United States, no matter who he is, and no matter how powerful he is. I don't think we have seen the end of or the final destiny of Jerusalem, city of Jerusalem. I think it cannot be determined. The destiny of Jerusalem cannot be determined by what a powerful person says. If it is not endorsed by the international community and by international law, as far as I'm concerned, it means nothing. You know, so I think we need to continue knowing that the people of power have been able to manage this and make a decision, but that's not the end of it. So that I just want to put it out right there. So we still need to continue working for justice and for peace for all the people of the land.
Tarek, you have any comments you want to offer?
Boy, do I. When I was speaking at the Congressional Black Caucus, this is about 10 years ago, at the end of my talk, Bernard Lafayette, whom was mentioned protege of Martin Luther King, asked me to go in his place. He said, I'm getting too old. They're tired of hearing about me. Why don't you go and give a newer message about Palestine? I spoke about my grandmother. I spoke about that wall, that 30-foot concrete wall. That is her backyard fence. And I told the tragedy in Palestine. Steny Hoyer at the time and John Lewis walked right into the presentation, hadn't heard it. And Steny Hoyer looked at me and said, had the Palestinians had a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King, they wouldn't be where they are today. I didn't respond at the time. I was much younger, and I just took it in. I would have responded, would you tell the same people on this Black Congressional Caucus the same thing back in 1940s and 50s? And then you ask us as Palestinians, where are your Gandhis? Well, 60 of them were shot in the past 2 days. If that is not nonviolence on the ground from Palestinians, I don't know what is. I come from Texas. You don't step on our backyard in Texas. You wear your cowboy boots and you shoot if somebody comes in your backyard. These folks, in 70 years, a lot of these people have been refugees in camps in Gaza and all around Palestine. So don't ask me where the Palestinian Gandhis are, where nonviolence is. It's been practiced for the past 100 years by Palestinians, and we're shooting them down. And don't expect for people to give you and pass out flowers after you have sieged them for 10 years, and 50% of them malnutritioned or not enough food to eat, and 50% without enough resources, electricity, and water. So the situation is dire, and our churches have to speak up more, and I know we'll get into that in a bit.
Well, and there's so much bad faith. I mean, you mentioned this constant mantra of demanding the Palestinian Gandhi. Where's the Palestinian Gandhi? You had a Thomas Friedman at the dawn of the Arab Spring write this column where he says, that if the youth of Palestine would just get out there and march in Jerusalem and march to the wall and just march against the occupation in this giant mass march and just start marching towards Israel, the world will respect them and Israelis will come and join their brothers and sisters and hug them and run across the street and sing Kumbaya. I mean, he's essentially saying, go out and do that while I sit here in Chevy Chase in my well-tended lawn and watch you. That essentially, in so many ways, happened last week. Thomas Friedman went on Anderson Cooper and he said, Hamas is sacrificing the youth of Gaza, and they are essentially to blame for their own deaths. This is the bad faith that we constantly see from our opinion makers. They actually don't want a Palestinian Gandhi. I always said this. They want a kind of a Palestinian Dalai Lama who will exist in exile and do peace concerts with celebrities while they basically take the whole place. We saw some really disturbing theology on display in Jerusalem. I mean, first on the Jewish side, you have extreme religious nationalists like Yitzhak Yosef, who is the son of the former Sephardic chief rabbi Ovadia Yosef, who's had some disturbing things to say about non-Jews. Yitzhak Yosef recently delivered a sermon comparing black people, in his words, kushim, which is considered sort of offensive, to monkeys. And he blessed Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. Also on the scene was Robert Jeffress. You might know him because you're from Texas. Robert Jeffress, when he was on the early in his career in the 90s, he was doing this campaign on the border of Oklahoma where he was taking books out of the local library that had gay themes in them. It was a campaign, Gay is Not Okay. And basically he'd raise money from his parishioners to pay for the books so they wouldn't be in the library because he would refuse to return them. This is someone who's not operating, in my view, on a pluralistic, democratic, normal plane. He's also said that Jews are going to hell. Jews or Mormons and Muslims are going to hell. They can't be saved. This was the person who delivered the opening benediction. The closing benediction was delivered by someone most of you are familiar with, John Hagee, the most prominent Christian Zionist in the world. As I reported in 2006, AIPAC actually helped set up his organization, Christians United for Israel. And Pastor Hagee at his Cornerstone Church in Texas has declared that the Antichrist will be like Hitler, half Jewish and homosexual with fierce features. So he has said that the Antichrist will be a half-breed Jew. That is Pastor John Hagee, who delivered the closing benediction at the U.S. Embassy alongside the presidential son-in-law, the Orthodox Jewish, Jared Kushner. Weird, right? It seems weird. But actually, I think it actually embodies a lot of what Zionism represents, which is a collaboration between anti-Semites in the West, who would like a West free of Jews, and Zionists, traditional Zionists, who believe that anti-Semitism is actually a force that can help propel Jews into making aliyah or emigrating to the Holy Land and helping drive this project of colonization. So there actually is this symbiotic relationship that was on display, and it's a traditional relationship, which is very disturbing. Naim, you wrote in your book, this is not your new book, this is Justice and Only Justice, but it's still a very worthy book, that Christian Zionists represent an omen of hate. What do you mean by an omen of hate, and how has Christian Zionism affected not only the lives of Palestinians, but how do you face this challenge as a Christian in the United States?
Well, Christian Zionism actually goes back many years before 1948. So from the beginning of the 19th century, we have the creation, the emergence of Christian Zionists. And these were Christians, evangelical, fundamentalist, extremist Christians, who, on the basis of their study of the scriptures, of the Bible, believed that in order for them to speed up the second coming of Christ, they need to get all the Jews to Palestine. Because in their interpretation of the Bible, Jews need to be there so that the final battle in history, the Battle of Armageddon, in their interpretation, will take place, and two-thirds of the Jewish people will be massacred, and the last third would become Christian. This is part of the teaching of Christian Zionism. It goes back to those early years. I'm talking about 1840s. I'm talking in the 1840s, a Christian Zionist by the name of Lord Shaftesbury in England was lobbying the British government to send all British Jews back to Palestine. Because he believed exactly what I told you, you know, about the interpretation of the scripture. In the United States, this type of teaching that actually started in Europe, in England, in Britain at the time, came to the United States by a person, John Nelson Darby. Again, he was born in the 1800s, early 1800s. And he came here and he talked about his dispensationalist perspective, which basically talked about what is going to happen at the end days, the end times of this. And one of his disciples was William Blackstone from Chicago, and he started lobbying President Harrison to send American Jews to Palestine in order to speed up the second coming of Christ. Yeah. And then Cyrus Scofield wrote his famous Scofield Bible, and which many fundamentalist American Christians were brought up on the Scofield Bible. And this, it was not... And then what happened is that His commentary on the Bible was perceived as part of inspired biblical Bible, you know. So they could not differentiate between the commentary of Scofield and the biblical text. It all became one for American Christian fundamentalists. And you still have in the United States millions of these Christian Zionists. And so this guy, Jeffers, who's the pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, he's one of those. John Hagee is one of those, except John Hagee, because of his relationship with Israel, he started changing, modifying, you know, his stance. But basically, they all believe in the second coming of Christ and that Jews, ultimately, most of them will be massacred and the last third will become Christian. Now, for many years, Jewish Israelis and Jewish Americans would not even have anything to do with these Christian Zionists because they felt they were anti-Semitic, and they are, in their view, anti-Semitic. But later on, most of them said, well, Jews would say, I don't really accept their theology. I don't accept their interpretation of the Bible, but we need them because they are very much pro-Israel. And they are very much committed to the state of Israel and against the Palestinians in that sense. So that's what has happened since 2000, I think. Since the year 2000, some of the Jews said, we welcome Christian Zionists because of their utmost loyalty to Israel. And I think some of them were there in Jerusalem. This time I heard about other people who went there because of this type of theology, which we would say it is bad interpretation of the Bible. It's bad understanding of the theology of the end times. It is unacceptable, but that's what we have.
It bears mentioning that when you talk about dispensations, I mean, a dispensation can come in the form of war. Pastor John Hagee has a book, Jerusalem Countdown, in which he favors a war on Iran in order to hasten the second coming. So you have essentially an apocalypse lobby, a national apocalypse lobby. I went to Christians United for Israel. You can watch my video, Rapture Ready. It's on YouTube. And I interviewed various attendees of the Christians United for Israel's 2007 Washington Israel Summit. And I said, are you looking forward to the apocalypse? One after another. I'm looking forward to the apocalypse and the cleansing of the earth. I mean, that kind of rhetoric. Looking forward to it. I'm not. Actually, maybe I am because I'll get their cars and stuff. I mean, they're going to be raptured up, so I'll be here. But on that note, I mean, you know, we've watched Christian communities come under attack in the Middle East from Israel and Lebanon, for example, in 2006. A lot of people don't know there's a Christian community in the Gaza Strip. Many people during Operation Protective Edge in 2014, I was in Gaza for part of that, took shelter in a Christian church because the church was not going to be targeted. Bethlehem is, of course, you know, just bleeding its Christian population because of the separation wall, because of so many factors related to the occupation. Why is there no solidarity between these conservative evangelical Christians and these Christian communities, which go back to the time of the apostles? Why is that? It was something that I think a lot of people wonder. Why are they considered collateral damage by so many evangelical Christians in the United States?
Yeah, they believe that we are nominal Christians. We are not really the true Christians. And I've heard it for many, you know, because they come... They don't come to Sabeel when they come to Jerusalem. They don't go to see the Christian churches, the indigenous churches of the land. And if you ask them, they will say, these are not good Christians. They are the ones who are the only good Christians in their view, because they think that we have to be converted to real Christianity, to the true religious faith, and that's why, you know, they don't consider us at all as true believers, true converted Christians in that sense. And it's very sad. So they would put us almost on the same category like the Muslims in that sense, that we also, not only the Muslims need to be converted, that the Christian, the nominal Christians of the land need to be converted, you know. And they will side with Israel against anyone who is not pro-Israel at all. So that's part of the whole thing. And when the churches, you mentioned about some people in Gaza went and to find refuge in the church. Actually, our church in Gaza, which is in the Ahli Arab Hospital, was bombed by the Israelis. Was bombed by the Israelis, and I don't know whether it's still been renovated. And I think the church tried to get the Israeli government to pay for the damage. And I, to my knowledge, I don't think they did. Do you have? I don't think they. And the NGO. Yeah. So I mean, people think that Israel, the government of Israel, likes the Christians more than the Muslims. But in actual fact, they don't like us both, because they don't like the Palestinians. And we are Palestinians, whether we are Christians or Muslims, we are Palestinians. So it the war of 1948 was not against Islam or the Muslims. It was against the Palestinians. You know, we were driven out in my home, Bisan. They did not ask us, are you a Christian? You can stay. Are you a Muslim? You need to go. Nobody asked us that way. Actually, what they did in Bisan, they put us two categories, Muslims and Christians, but they sent all the Muslims to Jordan, and they sent all the Christians into Nazareth, you know, at the time, you know. But in terms of taking the land, they wanted the land of Palestine, but they did not want the people of the land, the indigenous people of the land.
Let's go back to Bisan. I mean, it was Nakba Day this week. It was the 70th observance of the dispossession, a systematic dispossession of Palestinians. Some 750,000 Palestinians were forced from their homes and their land. And leading up to 1948, we have to recognize that over 200 villages had already been ethnically cleansed by that point, by the point that David Ben-Gurion declared quote-unquote independence. This is already a project well underway. But this is obviously the heart of the issue. I think that is a much larger motivating factor in these protests than the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. You were 11 years old?
Yes.
At this point. Yeah. Tell us what happened and how it influenced your perspective and led you to this Palestinian theory of liberation.
Yeah. Well, as an 11-year-old, I remember details of my life in Bisan and what happened. So I remember a beautiful town. I remember a town, God blessing it with so many springs of beautiful water, all the mountains around Bisan, the pools that we had, the springs that we had. I remember the garden that my father had, which he, when he bought a piece of land and built three houses on it. My father was a goldsmith and silversmith, and he was the only jeweler in town. And around Bisan, over 20 villages and towns, all of them came to Bisan, because Bisan was the capital of that region, you know. It had a bank. It had a post office. I'm talking about in the 1940s, you know, end of the 1940s. So it was a beautiful place. And my father when he got this land, we had a canal of beautiful spring water coming through our land. And I would help my father in irrigating the land. My father planted trees, fruit trees, in Bisan, in our garden. You might be familiar with one type of fig trees. We had four or five different types of fig trees in our land. The pomegranates, the bananas. Who has banana trees in their homes? But Bisan, we had it. You know, the oranges, the grapefruits that we had, the lemons. I mean, it was unbelievable. I have all this, plus the vegetable garden that we had in Bisan. It was a beautiful place. And our life totally was disrupted. Totally disrupted when the Zionists came into Bisan. And I was playing outside. Our house was on the main street of town, going through the town. And I remember, you know, seeing those Zionist troops going through. There was no war, no battle. They just occupied us. And a few days later, the military governor sent after the heads of the different churches and the Muslim community. In fact, I remember well that the word came to my father. My father represented the small Episcopal Anglican church in Bisan. And they sent after these heads. So I remember my father asking me to go to the Latin priest and ask him to come to our house, to the Orthodox church priest, and come. And my father asked me to go to the other side of town to the Qadi. Qadi is the judge, the Muslim judge of the town. And he asked me to go ask the Qadi to come to our home because they were sent after by the military Jewish governor of Bisan. And I did. I did. And they all came, and then I saw them leave to go to the military governor. And the military governor told them, you have 2 hours to get out of town. And my father pleaded with him, told him, I have 10 children. My 2 kids, older kids, are married and they have kids. There is nowhere we can go. This is our home. This is where we are. You've occupied us. Allow us to stay in our home. And I remember my father telling us, he said, no way. If you don't leave, we will kill you. My father came to the house and he said, we are asked to get out. We must meet at the center of town. Carry whatever you can, light and valuable. We cannot take anything more with us. I remember my father was well-to-do, so we had our own bakery in the house. He had built it. So in those days, people would prepare the dough, and then they go to different bakeries. But we did not have to go, because one of my seven sisters, you know, was our baker. So she would do the bakery, and another sister would prepare the dough, you know. And we had the dough prepared for that day. And my father said, you know, get the oven, you know, and let's take the bread, you know, the bread. And immediately, the dough was not even ripe for baking. But we had to do it because they said 2 hours, you need to get out. So anyway, we carried the fresh bread. And we went to the center of town, and that's where they divided us. And they said, Muslims on one side, Christians on the other. And then they took all the Muslims down the River Jordan, which was few kilometers away, few miles away, maybe 3 miles at the most, you know, to the Jordan. And they told the Muslims, go to the King Abdullah. This is the grandfather of the present king. in Jordan. And they took all of us Christians. At that time, Nazareth was still with the Palestinians, with the Arabs. It was not occupied. They dumped us on the outskirts of Nazareth. And then the buses and cars started coming from Nazareth to pick us up. We were very fortunate. I mean, we became refugees, that's right. But my father was able to smuggle out the gold. And my sisters hid that gold under their dresses. So we came to Nazareth, and the Anglican Church took us in. The priest there took us in. They closed the schools because of the war, and we occupied the school. Not only us, my family, but several Anglican families that came out from Bisan. And so we stayed in the school. According to the family, one room, one classroom, or more, you know, to accommodate these people. And we only had the clothes on our back, you know. I experienced that. And one of the hardest things I remember, I wanted a banana. As a boy, I said, I want a banana. And back home, we had the bananas all hanging, you know, those big, I don't know what you call them in English, but they were all hanging there in the oven, in the bakery, so that they can become ripe, you know. And I was so upset because when they got me a banana, I could only have one banana. One banana, when we had all the bananas and all the oranges and all the fruits and the teen, the figs and so on, you know. It was unbelievable. But we had to adjust in Nazareth. And what happened to my family, you have to imagine, happened to thousands and thousands of Palestinian families throughout Palestine. Some people fled because they already heard about what the Zionists had done in Deir Yassin and the massacre of over 100 men, women, and children in Deir Yassin. So some people fled. We did not flee at gunpoint. We had to leave Bisan. And then, as you mentioned, in order to prevent the refugees from returning, the government of Israel bulldozed around 500 villages and towns throughout Palestine. And you can find maps. If you Google, you will find the maps of the different villages and towns that have been bulldozed in order to prevent the Palestinians from returning. Now, our homes in Bisan, most of our homes in Bisan were not demolished. They brought Jewish families from North Africa, especially Morocco, that took over our homes in Bisan. And I remember 10 years later, because we could not move after that. We could not get out of Nazareth without a military permit. If you wanted to go from Nazareth to another place, you had to have a permit. I remember the people who just, you know, families divided and so on. If I wanted to go to Haifa, I had to have a military permit. And then I found out that 10 years, they allowed us to go back to Bisan, or people were allowed to go to their original home only on the day of the independence of the State of Israel. I'm sorry to take this long time, but let me just end by saying, we went back to Bisan after 10 years. And we knocked on the door of our home. We had a big home there. And we found out that there were a number of families. They divided our house into different parts. And my father said, can we go in and say, and this woman just shut the door in his face and told him, that's our home. It's not. We went back to Nazareth. In a few days, my father had a stroke and he never recovered. And he passed away. He died after 5 years of the what do you call it, the stroke that he had, you know, there. So this is part of our story in Bisan.
And as you explained, it's ongoing. The Nakba is a continuous, ongoing process. Let's talk about a little bit more history. I think that you gathered your theory of liberation during the First Intifada, am I correct?
Yes.
And that was, you were doing conversions, but you'd also studied theology at San Francisco State?
Berkeley.
At Berkeley. Just before the Intifada. And leading up to that, you wrote about in your book the campaigns of Joseph Raya.
Yes.
In Christian areas in what is now Israel, in organizing people. He was one of the first priests to organize people.
Yes.
Put this all together for us. Just how did this lead to, how did this crystallize into your theory of liberation, being a part of the Intifada, the backdrop of Raya's campaigns and studying in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's a journey. It has been a journey. That Nakba that was ongoing, it never really finished because Israel, the government of Israel, started confiscating Palestinian land continuously. And the situation, the discrimination, the loss of identity, the loss of, in my new book, I mentioned not only one Nakba, I mentioned three Nakbas that we were subjected to. But I believe that one of the first people to raise the whole question of justice for the Palestinians from a religious perspective was a priest by the name of Joseph Raya. He was Lebanese, but most of his education was in Palestine, and he felt Palestinian, and he studied in Jerusalem, and he was ordained in Jerusalem also before he was asked to go to Birmingham, Alabama, to be the parish priest of the Melkite community in Birmingham. And while in Birmingham, he marched with Martin Luther King. So he absorbed the technique of nonviolent resistance. And while in Birmingham, we lost, or the bishop, the Melkite bishop in Haifa, retired, and the Melkites chose Raya as a bishop. So he was ordained and he came to Haifa. I had just started my ministry at the end of the 1966. In 1988, he came to Haifa. And he started coming to the different places. When he came to Shafa Amir, where I was the parish priest there, I was asked by the other clergy in town to give the welcome to Bishop Raya. And I did that, and as a result of this and other things, we became good friends. And then I was transferred from Shafa Amir to Haifa, where he was. So I used to see him more. Bishop Raya felt that he can now raise the question of Palestine. So he was very smart. So he took the case of Ikrit and Kufr Birim. You remember that. Kufr Birim and Ikrit were two Christian villages in the north of Palestine that were evicted, the people were evicted by the Zionist militias. And they told the villagers, after 2 weeks you can come back. Well, the 2 weeks ran into years. As you know. So the villagers went to the Supreme Court in Israel and said, look, this is what happened. These are the papers. So the Supreme Court, at least in that case, they were honest. So they ruled that the villagers should go back to their villages. Golda Meir was the prime minister at the time, the one who said there are no Palestinians. So she refused to honor, to implement its own Supreme Court ruling. and the Israeli army went and demolished the two villages. One of the villages was demolished on Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve. So Bishop Raya said to the Israeli government, your ruling, you need to implement it. And so he started demonstrating. He started having people, sit-ins. He will come from Haifa with many people. And not only Christians joined him. Many Muslims and many communists in those days. And the Communist Party was made up of Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Yeah, the Socialist Party. So they all started doing it. One Sunday in August, during that period, he became bishop 68, 68, 69, and was there until 74. One Sunday, he told all the churches, Melka churches, to close down and ring toll the bell with a toll of the al-huzun, you know, the grief, the funeral toll, and announce the death of justice in Israel. He was an amazing guy. Amazing guy. And the government of Israel would not budge. Would not budge. And then they started putting pressure on Raya. Russia came from outside and from inside. And finally, poor guy, he had to resign his see and get out of the country. And he came to Canada. And I came twice to Canada during that period, and I saw him. And I told him how much I have appreciated his stance for justice. And he died in Canada. So that was one time in which the voice of justice was heard. And then Elias Shakur took over from Raya because he was one of his priests, you know, young priests. And then Palestinian liberation theology started with the first intifada in 87, 88.
Describe, you know, tell us, what is your vision of Palestinian liberation theology? And, you know, I have your book, and I also have James Cone's Black Theology of Liberation. James Cone recently passed away. He makes explicit mention to the Palestinian struggle in his book. He draws a lot of inspiration from it. And we also have the model of liberation theology in Latin America. Archbishop Romero, who was assassinated during yes. sermon at the height of the Salvadoran Civil War, is the person that we think of most. And this is a theology that was attacked by the CIA through the Vatican. All of these theologies have come under extreme pressure. Black theology of liberation has come under pressure from prosperity gospel, you know, this yes. phony gospel of T.D. Jakes. It's a worship of capitalism. And the Palestinian theology of liberation has come under attack from so many sides. But, you know, what is it and why is it seen as such a threat to so many in power, and how is it different or similar to these other two streams of thought that I mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, liberation theology tries to be true to its name, liberation. Where there is oppression, where there is injustice. In Latin America, it was economic injustice. When I remember while you were talking, one of the liberation theologians, a bishop, who said, when I help the poor, they call me a saint. When I say, why are they poor? They call me a communist. Amazing. So when you begin to ask the right questions about what's happening, why are these people oppressed? What's the origin of the injustice? And so on. People in power don't like that. They want to dominate. They want to take the land. I'm talking about Palestine. They want to push the people out, the indigenous people of the land. So liberation theology You know, when it started at St. George's Cathedral when I was the parish priest there. In 87, when the Intifada started, I was just like many other priests, trying just to be faithful to God in serving the people. And I decided, with the Intifada, I decided to invite our people in the church to stay after church every Sunday for 1 hour in order to really talk about what's happening on the ground, what's happening in the streets. I think you were there. You know, Tom Getman, I think Karen May came later. Yeah. And so, in the beginning, it would seem like a session of therapy, you know, because what people did, they came and they told the stories of what was happening outside, and they'd bring it out, you know, the anger, the frustration, you know, the sadness, the tragedies of their own tragedies and the tragedies of their neighbors, you know, people beaten up, people in jail, people, you know, killed and so on. That was the thing. And people would talk about it. But then we started deepening the discussion at St. George's. And more Christians started coming from the Orthodox churches and the Catholic churches of the land. And so the numbers swelled at St. George's. You know, people who wanted to come and express what's happening there. And basically, we were talking about how can we live our life of faith under an oppressive occupation. That, and talk about the need for liberation and what does that mean. And the discussion became deeper and broader when people started seeing Jesus as a paradigm of liberation. Because they started saying, my goodness, Jesus was born under occupation, the Roman occupation. Jesus lived all his life under occupation. All his ministry, his teaching, his healing, his interaction with people, all was done living life under a very oppressive Roman occupation. It was amazing. Yeah. And at the end, he was killed by the occupation forces in collusion with the religious leaders of the day. And usually when there is injustice, many times it's not only the political powers, it's also the religious powers that are in collusion with the political powers. So the people were talking about this at St. George's. And especially when it came to the point in which they started seeing Jesus Christ as a Palestinian living under occupation. So immediately they started identifying with Jesus. And that's when Jesus becomes the liberator, the paradigm of liberation. That's the beginning. And providentially, all this happened when my manuscript for the first book was ready. And it was sent to Orbis Books through Mark Ellis, who is a Jewish liberation theologian. He wrote about Jewish liberation theology. And he came to Jerusalem, and I went to listen to his, and I saw how he was attacked by the Jewish people in Jerusalem, West Jerusalem. And I was there, and Shakur was there. And I went to him and invited him to come to my home at St. George's. And he came with his family. And I gave him to look at my dissertation. And he said, I'm going to take it to Orbis. And a year later, 1989, the book was published. But already Palestinian liberation theology had started by the people themselves. And I am not exaggerating if I tell you that the best ideas came from the Palestinian Christians who were feeling the oppression, and they were beginning to express it, you know, and when they were talking about it, the best ideas came from them. And they were profound, I would say profound liberation theologians, you know, the simple people who feel the oppression, and they're saying, what does it mean for me to be faithful to God, you know, in resisting the oppression and the injustice there. That was the beginning of Palestinian liberation theology, and from there it started spreading in Palestine and, thank God, to other places of the world.
You have been listening to Reverend Niam Atik, director of the Sabeel Ecumenical Liberation Theology Center in Jerusalem, journalist and author Max Blumenthal, and Tariq Abwata of Friends of Sabeel North America. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
The mysteries originated in the Middle East and have spread across the world. And so they take a large percentage of the mysticism and the religion and the magic and the occult knowledge of the people of the Middle East. Most Freemasons do not even understand that when they circumambulate the lodge with the master sitting in the east representing the rising sun, that they are practicing an ages-old pagan rite to their true deity. Albert Pike himself revealed the true God of Freemasonry. And he and many others have made the clear statement that Freemasonry is indeed a religion.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Could the VI paedophile cover-up go right to the top of the Metropolitan Police? Testimony tonight from an ex-Scotland Yard detective. Also, Jens Stoltenberg has been in the UK this week, and Prime Minister Theresa May has been increasing Britain's commitment to his NATO alliance. Nevertheless, he says it could all break up. We look also at one powerful arm of the Israel lobby tonight, which began around the same time as the Zionist project back in the late 1800s, the B'nai B'rith. What do these Hebrew words mean? And what are they, and what is their real agenda? What's the B'nai B'rith's links to Las Vegas gangster Meyer Lansky and the Party of Organised Crime in the United States? Why was their Anti-Defamation League committee silent all during Hitler's persecution of the Jews? Who better to answer that than the Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany's lawyer Jacob Chaitkin's son, author of the unauthorised biography of George Bush Sr., Anton Chaitkin? Also, bringing the look at the Israel lobby bang up to date, time to ask Israeli saxophonist, now based in the UK, Gilad Atzmon, why he believes the origin of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party and elsewhere is a vicious circle. how far-right Zionist leaders like Netanyahu perversely benefit from anti-Semitism. Finally, he looks at why pro-Palestinian musicians such as Pink Floyd's Roger Waters are considered such a threat by the Israel lobby. Our sister show Dialects on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. You can catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, We Are Change Rotterdam stopped by to tell us about their work in Turin, Italy, reporting on the Conference of the Secret Rulers of the Western World, the Bilderberg Conference. Plus, we travelled to Peru with Bristolian Chris Woods, who decided to follow up in the footsteps of Sting, Tori Amos, David Icke and others to try out the hallucinogenic drug ayahuasca. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday, or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, we've got this Donald Trump visit. This is going to kind of concentrate people's minds next month, isn't it, on all these issues going on around the world. And we hear again, literally today, a report that a US airstrike has killed 8 in eastern Syria. I mean, it does seem as if the Americans are there to stay in Syria.
Yeah, despite Donald Trump saying that they were going to leave. So that shows you who really determines the policy in the United States, and it ain't Donald Trump.
In the background to all of this, of course, we've got the trade war going on.
Yeah.
Trump is threatening EU with 20% tariffs on all cars. The trade war does seem to be escalating. It's like a ratchet.
Yeah. Yeah.
As one side puts another tariff on, so the EU and the United States... the trouble here, of course, is that there are enormous corporations that are... transnational. They're based both in the EU and in the United States.
Yeah, and if you see what's happening in the stock markets, they're starting to wobble. And if there's a full-on trade war, they'll crash. And that's what will happen. And then people say, well, where'd all the money go? And it'll just have disappeared down the drain. And that's where we're at. I'm afraid it's most likely outcome, by far.
Well, what's your prognosis for Syria? Because we've got the Russians absolutely not... They're not going anywhere. They're definitely staying there. But the Americans, it doesn't seem as if they want to leave either. We've also got fractures going on within the NATO alliance. It was announced this week that the new F-35, although it's a little bit of a dodgy aeroplane, the most high-tech aircraft being produced by the US for NATO, Turkey is now not allowed to buy it. They wanted to buy some, I imagine, to let the Russians have a look at one, but they've been told by the Congress now you're not allowed to have these things.
Well, that's because they decided to buy the SS-400s from Russia. So, I mean, the world is in flux, and Syria, of course, is the cauldron in which these geopolitical battles are being fought, much to the unfortunate luck of the poor old Syrian people who've been put through the mincer by all of this politicking.
Can you just give us a short version of why Syria has been right at the apex of this over the last nearly 10 years now, and why it looks as if it's going to continue to be at the apex in the future?
Well, General Wesley Clark, the former head of NATO Europe, I think he was, he said, well, I was told by senior people in the Pentagon that we were going to attack, 7 countries in 5 years, and Syria was on the list. And of course,
Iran was on the list.
Yes,
well,
yes, Iran is still on the list.
Lebanon was on the list.
Lebanon isn't directly on the list, but the implication is that that's going to be dragged into the war in Syria. And what happened was they thought that the Assad regime in Syria was going to collapse in the same way as the Gaddafi regime in Libya.
So, as America's
and of course, it didn't
take over the Middle East ground to a halt now.
Yeah, because the battles around Damascus are like the Stalingrad of World War III, and the Americans have been beaten. They're not accepting being beaten. All they can do now is sabotage the peace, but they're going to do that. They're determined to do
so that. So Jens Stoltenberg's been in the Secretary General of NATO in London this week. Let's hear from him and Theresa May.
Thank you so much, Prime Minister Theresa. Thank you for welcoming me here today, and thank you for your personal commitment to our alliance. The United Kingdom has long led by example in NATO, and you continue to do so. You lead the NATO battle group in Estonia. Royal Air Force jets patrol the skies over the Black Sea.
Today, the Secretary General and I welcome the progress made on modernising NATO while recognising that there is more to do. There's been much discussion about the need for allies to take on greater responsibility by increasing their spending on defence, and we welcome the steps that NATO allies have taken since the Wales summit 4 years ago. Burden sharing will be one of the key items on the agenda for the summit in July, where we will take stock of progress since the leaders' meeting last May and the Warsaw and Wales summits.
But Theresa May talks also there, Martin, about one of the things she says is that there's an increasing commitment to more and more military officers in Britain taking on NATO roles.
Well, I mean, we're having our arms twisted up our back by the Americans to spend 2% of GDP on military. I'm basically buying the stuff from the Americans. That's what we'll be buying the F-35, and that means that we're closing hospitals and schools and closing libraries and toilets, but we're going to spend money on the F-35, and that's what that's all about. And, of course, why is the British Army in Estonia, for example? We promised Gorbachev years ago that if he allowed freedom in Eastern Europe and let the Berlin Wall come down, that NATO wouldn't expand one inch towards Russia. And now, of course, right on Russia's border. What would we do if the Russians were having very serious exercises in France about invading the south of England? How would we feel about that? And, of course, the Russian army on the other side of the border from Estonia are watching, you know, with some alarm, these exercises. And, of course, the potential for conflict is quite big in the Baltic states. You've got a very large Russian minority, particularly in Latvia and less so in Lithuania. So the potential for conflict is definitely there. And we're going around kicking sandcastles over. And eventually, do you know what? We might get the fight we claim we don't want. And then what would we do?
BCFM. Well, we're going to come back home now and to the UK and revisit, as we do quite regularly on this programme, the VI paedophile scandal. That is really the government's complete failure to have any kind of proper inquiry into the very serious allegations of VI paedophilia, particularly having the Home Office manage the inquiry, the national inquiry into child sexual abuse. The Home Office being, of course, the prime suspects in actually being involved in child sexual abuse themselves. And it was quite fascinating, I thought, last weekend to hear, and I'm going to share it with you now, this interview with DC Paul Wedger. He's a former Metropolitan Police detective who has looked very deeply into this. And I would suggest if you've got any children around that you turn the radio down, or the children shouldn't be listening to this, or we may wish to make sure kids can't listen. But here is what I thought was a very powerful description by him of the corruption that he saw within the Metropolitan Police about child sexual abuse. So here is now DC Paul Wedger.
I'm recently retired from the Metropolitan Police, where I served as a detective. I specialised in child abuse investigations, and what is relevant to me being here today was my service whilst on the specialist vice unit. I had been asked to look into an allegation made by a 14-year-old girl that she is being used as a prostitute. On looking into it, it appeared that this girl was one of many. She gave me another girl, who in turn gave me another, and it just spiralled. Very, very quickly, we had dozens of young kids aging from 9 to 14 years old. All of them were subject to care orders, either looked after or, you know, in placements, homes or whatever, but all known to the social services. A lot of them were known to the police for being missing persons and everything else. And all of them were addicted to crack cocaine and heroin and were all being pimped out, as the term goes, by one person, which was a female prostitute who was very well known to the Met Police. And this woman had alleged connections with high-ranked officers and also a local magistrate and someone that was high up here, executive status in the BBC. This woman seemed to work with impunity for many, many years, and when looking into it, this actual racket had been going on for a long, long time. What I did was I exposed my findings, I committed them to paper in what was just a basic intelligence report, and I took it to a senior officer. And what I must say that this isn't the first time that I'd been shut down for exposing child abuse offences. A couple of years prior to that, if I may jump the timeline, was I was on an inquiry looking into transient paedophiles that had failed to register, and I found out that they were residing on canal boats within the inland waterway network of the UK. They had information from within the prison service that there were two paedophiles that were living on boats, that there was freedom to travel. The canal network was very, very old and therefore didn't get policed. And children like boats. And the BBC had a programme at the time. It was to do with two little dolls that lived on a canal boat called Rosie and Jim. And it was tied in at the same time as I was looking into this. So kids were drawn to the waterways. The reason for telling this bit was that I was told that there were two sex offenders. I was asked to look into it as a field intelligence officer, and if I found another two within a set period of time, they'd be happy. Within that period of time, I'd found 90. I came into work, and I was told by a high-ranked officer that the inquiry had been shut down, and the reason given was that they couldn't afford the funding for me. But I had been approached by a Scotland Yard detective who told me, he said, when you investigate any crime and you do well at it, you get praised. When you look into child abuse cases, the opposite happens. Be very careful. He then told me about a cabinet minister that they'd investigated on a few occasions, and on each occasion they've been shut down. So I was aware that this had gone on. When I questioned the senior officer about, you know, the real reason, he told me, John, I'm so sorry it's come from high up. There's nothing I can do. And promised me any job I wanted. So I moved on to the vice unit. So I was expecting to be praised for what I found out. Each day a new child would be found, and it was just spiralling. I was brought before someone who is now a very, very high-ranked officer in the UK indeed, and he sat me down and he said, John, I've got to be very upfront with you. And I said, well, I'd like to be upfront with you, Governor, as well. And he said, you know, you're out of all the officers I've got here, there was about, I don't know, 40 officers, he said, you're the second best one I've got, which was a good accolade, he said, but unfortunately, you've dug too deep. What the hell have you done? Now, on a personal level, since the beginning of 2000, I'd brought up four children on my own, and this was common knowledge within my unit. And he said to me, if you ever disclose what you found out, you will lose your home, your children, and your job. You must shut the F up. And he said, you will be thrown to the wolves. You have no idea who and what you are dealing with. He said, I'm warning you now, you must back away. And then he said something quite strange, and he said that if you say a word of this, and even if you make a complaint, it will come back to me, and it will go in the bin. I and no one else will ever betray fellow rank. Shut your mouth. So I walked away from that investigation, and I moved on. I was offered to stay, but I couldn't. What was very strange was that the main witness, the young girl that came forward, was found dead in the street very shortly afterwards on a suspicious drug overdose, which sort of compounded matters. I then moved on to work on child abuse investigations, which is slightly different to Vice, and I can explain why there is this compartmentalisation within these institutions. And it's all down to remits, justifiable reasons for actually doing nothing as opposed to doing something. I went on to a child abuse unit in one of the poorer boroughs of London, and I was asked if I would like, as well as an investigator, take on a second role dealing with various sort of issues they have. And I was told you'll get a day here and there to go to a meeting. And I asked to look into if there anyone was dealing with children's homes. I was told no, there was an officer that was dealing with children's homes, but she left 2 years ago and she didn't do anything anyway because nothing happens, there's no problem. And I asked this sergeant, are there any problems with child prostitution within the kids' homes? He said, what are you on about? No, of course not. I got a list, and this is almost real time as I'm telling it now. I got a list faxed through to me from social services with all the children's homes. There was 26 kids' homes. I picked up the phone and I spoke to the fella and I asked him how many kids they have. And on an average, there's about five children reside in these children's homes. And I said, no, I'm not pointing the finger. No one's in any trouble. How many of these children do you lose at the weekend? Which is the usual pattern of missing, you know, when kids go missing. And so out of the five, we lose three. And I said, no, honestly, what happens to them? They went, oh, they've been pimped out. This officer that had dealt with it for years had found none within this, honestly, this was the time as we're speaking now, within this period of minutes, I found three. By the end of that day, I'd found six. By the end of 3 days to 5 days, I'd found 50. I held a meeting with all the concerned agencies, which involved charities, which involved NGOs, which involved social services, and I highlighted the problem. And I was then harangued, really. I was attacked verbally by head of children's services for this borough, saying to me, what the effing hell have you done? And I said, well, you knew about these kids. I said, yeah, but they hadn't come notice, so we're not worried. The children were making money, so therefore the children weren't worried. The children had a boyfriend, which was their pimp. Therefore, they thought this was love. And the children were also using drugs, so therefore they want to continue to use drugs. So they weren't coming to notice. So therefore social services had written them off, despite the fact that the children's homes would constantly be getting in the logs that they were being picked up and they were going missing. These were regular missing persons. The police have a missing persons unit. They say so many thousands of kids go missing every year. They do, but a lot of them do return. But what is never looked into is what happens when they're going missing. They are working as prostitutes. The child abuse units won't look into them because they say it's not interfamilial, because it's someone else pimping them out. The bigger cities have vice units. Vice units will not deal with them because they say that these are kids subject to care orders. So no one looks into it, and it goes on, and it festers, and it festers. And then, funny enough, after this meeting, I was shut down and moved again. I then came forward a couple of years later. I was actually genuinely concerned that I would lose my children. I know how powerful the police are, and I know what they're capable of, having worked with them. I blew the whistle a few years ago, and I was told that my allegations would be taken at the highest level. I asked to speak to a high-ranked female detective. This was questioned. And then they did get me a high-ranked female detective, and she said to me, why are you talking to me and no one else? I said, because you cannot roll up your trouser leg. And she said, I understand exactly what you mean. They instigated allegations of corruption against high-ranked officers. When you investigate these crimes, as a witness and informant as I was, you're meant to get regular updates every 28 days. I never received one in 3 years. The matter was passed from one unit to another unit. It ended up with the IPCC, who again did nothing and failed to update me, despite the fact that they had corroborating evidence. I met with other police whistleblowers via a few concerned MPs. One of them was a lady called Maggie Oliver, who had exposed the scandal in Rochdale. Another one was a man called Lenny Harper, who had exposed the horrendous goings-on at a kid's home called Hope de la Garenne in Jersey. Each one of them echoed each other. They both said, they're going to come for you, and they will come hard. And I said, what do I expect? They said, right, you will be served with gross misconduct papers. You will be interviewed. They will find against you. You will be sacked, and you will probably face a court case and may go to jail. Now, the threats that was echoed to me, you'll lose your home, your job, your children. At the same time, the police stopped paying me. I went without wages for nearly 3 years. I had four children. Then what happened was that they served me gross misconduct papers, and I was told what it would be for data protection violations, which seems to be a common occurrence. I got served with numerous data protection violations. Each one could have given me a 2-year prison sentence. This continued and continued. Now, what also happened during this period was that one of my children was involved in a life-changing and catastrophic accident in which he was initially declared dead. They revived him. He was on life support for many, many months. I got called to attend the hospital where they had actually lost him. He'd been dead for 10 minutes. So I was called down to the hospital to basically identify him. I turned up and they had actually revived him within this period, but they deemed him as brain dead, although he was on full 100% life support. A colleague of mine was so concerned, as I had no money, and for 3 days I slept in my car and stayed by my son's side. My son actually made signs of life, and I was able to return home. But my colleague had brought this to the attention of senior officers, just saying, you know, you've got to help this man. He's actually done nothing wrong. The Met Police's response to this, when I got home, they'd sent two child protection officers round to interview my youngest boy on allegations that I'd left him home alone while I was with my dying son. So the threats of you will lose your home, your job and your children rang true. I persisted. I refused to give up. And I set up a forum, a working group with all the police whistleblowers. And it extended and it branched out. The IPCC stopped investigating the crime. I was meant to be given a full breakdown of what went on, and I was given a one-paragraph letter and told not to contact them again. We're not investigating it. Their answer was that the three high-ranked officers that I'd accused of corruption, they went and spoke to them, and they denied it, and that was the extent of their investigation. And all them years as an investigator, I've been doing it wrong. You've just got to ask someone if they've done it, and if they say no, that's it. And that was what they expected me to swallow and told me not to contact them again. I took the matter to the policing minister at the time, a member of the Privy Council and a member of the government's cabinet. He met with me, and he was actually, to my surprise, appalled. He arranged for a meeting with the Home Office. The Home Office then got their independent investigation team involved and stated that there will be an independent investigation into my claims. And they deemed that the Met Police and the IPCC had failed and they will look into it. I was summoned to a meeting, and it was a fully recorded meeting, and it was witnessed, in which the Cabinet Minister handed my paperwork over to the Home Office officials. And that was an official handover of the paperwork, which I supplied to him. They then gave me their assurances that they will be in touch with me and gave me a 24-hour contact number and said they will investigate this independently. I never heard from them again. They have since denied receiving any paperwork. When pushed, they admitted they did receive it, but have now lost it. We are seeing police failings in respect to child prostitution hemorrhaging in this country, but we are seeing them on a provincial level. We're seeing them in Rochdale, Blackpool, Rotherham. We're seeing them in Oxford, Aylesbury, Swindon, all on a provincial level. London is one of the largest urban conurbations in the Western world. It has got one of the biggest police forces. We haven't heard one thing about organised child prostitution in London, and the reason being is that those high up have been covering it up, and this goes right to the heart. I was met with, as I said, Lenny Harper. Children were killed at Haute de la Garenne, in which Lenny Harper had forensic evidence, which then went missing. And he said to me, be careful, what you're looking at will go right to the heart of the establishment. I sat down with the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Cressida Dick, and I explained to her what was going on. And I explained the dynamics of how you groom a child. I said, I can take a child out of a care system. I can groom that child. I can have sex with that child. I can get my friends to have sex with that child. I can pimp that child out. You have not appointed one officer to investigate that. Yet if I leant over my fence and called my neighbour a derogatory term, I'd lose my home, my job, I'd be signing on a register. And I'd never work for the Met Police again. How is that justifiable? How is it justifiable? I now work with victims and survivors of abuse. I help out with recovering alcoholics and drug addicts. I'm working in collusion now with one of the most notorious gangsters the UK had, and the convicted murderer, Chris Lambriano. And I've never had such support and compassion from these people, yet the police would have had me swinging from a rope if they've had their own way. When we look at our prison system, 75% of inmates are illiterate. This is in the UK, they're illiterate. 75% of our inmates have come from abused backgrounds. We have a recidivism rate of 75%. The system does not work. Child abuse is at the root of all of this. Child abuse units, when I was on them, I've worked on many specialist units in the police. I've worked on units that have been anti-government. I've worked on units that have been financial crime. You get given a car, You get given an expense account, you get given unlimited overtime. When I was on child abuse, we had a car between 10 of us. I worked with three alcoholics because the work was so horrendous and impactive. We had no respite. We were worked till we were dropping. And we would have appointments to see psychiatrists every 6 months, but they weren't to sign us off. They were to keep us going. Say, oh, you're all right, you're all right. Keep going, keep going. They deliberately underfund anything to do with child abuse. Deliberately, and it's done for a reason. I had many informants that came from the street. They were beggars. They were drug addicts. They had all been sexually abused as children. One of them told me of a scenario when he was in a kid's home at the age of four, was raped on his first night by a Catholic priest. He then went on to be raped daily and whipped and beaten. He became a drug addict and he ended up as a rent boy on the street at an area of the West End where I used to work as a vice copper. And that was what was classed as the meat rack in Piccadilly Circus, where young boys were openly picked up for the purpose of prostitution. It was known about. He went to get in a car and he was in trouble. He needed drugs, so he needed the money. And he had a pimp, and he said, a pimp wasn't a bad thing. A pimp actually looked after me. I was safer with a pimp on the street than I was in a kid's home. He went to get into a car, which was a white Rolls Royce with two men in it. And his pimp said, don't go in that car. The last two boys went in there. They killed them. We never saw them again. He gesticulated for the driver to drive around the block. And his pimp didn't see this. His pimp thought he'd walked away. But he didn't. He got in the car. He was then taken to a very affluent part of London called Hampstead. He was then subjected to 3 days of torture and sexual violence, in which he said that they knew that they'd killed him. And he said they dumped his lifeless body on Hampstead Heath by the Royal Free Hospital, believing he was dead. And he said, what shocked me more, John, was the fact that these two men, they were well-dressed, they had a big house, and they were actually getting ready to go to their niece's wedding whilst they were dropping my perceived lifeless body off on a bit of heath ground. Yet it goes on consistently, consistently. Back in 2003, the justice system brought in what they called the Bad Character Act. Before, you could never bring in someone's previous convictions within a legal trial in the UK, unless it was a very, very serious one, and then it was very difficult. There were too many legal parameters. They brought this in, and everyone thought that it was a coup. It was a step forward in gaining justice. But when you commit acts, minor acts, of shoplifting, it's dishonest crime. You are then deemed a dishonest person. Every person I dealt with, every street person, every crack-taking prostitute had been abused as a child. They all committed dishonest crime to stay alive. Right? They shoplifted. They pimped themselves. Whatever they did it to survive, to buy their drugs, to carry on. So whenever they were brought in a trial as a witness, they were instantly deemed as dishonest. And this is what we're seeing now when people are coming forward. They are rubbish and they're broken. And one of the startling things that occurred was back in the beginning of 2000, they brought over Mayor Giuliano from New York to preach to us on a thing called the broken window theory. And what his theory was, that if there was an area that of depravity that had a broken window or a damaged bus shelter, to clean it up, smarten it up, you won't get your drug dealers, you won't get your shoplifters, you won't get your robberies, that all these crimes that are in the periphery around sort of poverty and everything else, and therefore your society gets better. Smarten his broken windows up. It was naive at the least. Where is this timeline taken back? The fact is, they're doing drugs because they're paying for heroin. They're on heroin because heroin is an analgesic. It's a painkiller. Pain can be mental, emotional, as well as physical. And the majority of them were there doing the drugs because they come from the care system. The care system that had appallingly let them down, and that they had been sexually abused, and they had no way of processing the damage that had been done to them. Our judicial system sets them up to fail. It follows them through from cradle to grave. These kids are known about, yet nothing happens. They grow up, they become bad in class, they become violent. They get reported to the social services, yet the problem is still not addressed. They then commit minor acts and end up before the juvenile courts. Again, nothing is done. They commit then heavier acts, robberies or whatever, and end up before the magistrates' courts, yet nothing is done. They end up before the Crown Courts, and ultimately they end up going before the coroner's courts. Yet throughout all this circle, nothing ever breaks it. The people that are paid a good living wage to stop this are failing it. And sometimes it's deliberate, sometimes it's apathy, sometimes it's ignorance. I've just come back from Rotherham, a small steel town in the northwest cluster of the UK. I met with a social worker who had exposed the child prostitution problem. She ran an outreach group and the kids were coming to her, and then one would tell her, another chat, and she looked into it. It was organised prostitution. It's a small little town. 2,000 children were being pimped out. She got attacked. She got attacked from the police. Her husband nearly lost his job. It nearly brought her to this point of suicide. And this is what they do. It's orchestrated and it was manipulated at the highest echelons. She said it was coming from the high-ranking officers. And it was. But yet all they would offer up would be the lower-ranking officers for some form of malfeasance, whatever. But it is being orchestrated at the very top. My investigation showed a strong link with high-ranked officers and organised criminals. I spoke with another child abuse investigator, a quite high-ranked officer, and I spoke to him from Manchester. Again, he had a proven link between high-ranked officers and organised criminals and child prostitution there. We had a glimmer of hope in the form of a chief constable, a commissioner of police for a county called Wiltshire. The man's name is Mike Veal. He stood up and he investigated child prostitution, child trafficking, child abuse, everything else, but involved former Prime Minister Ted Heath. He turned around in Parliament and he said, if they can attack me, because he came under attack, and he said he came under attack from places he didn't even know existed. And he said, if they can attack me, God knows what they'll do to John Wedger, which in a way was a bit of an accolade. But, and I spoke to him and he said, it's just vile, John. It is vile. I then looked at the policeman's biggest fear is going to prison. And they know it. They know it. This is deliberate. What we're looking at is deliberate. When you're a policeman, you take an oath and your oath is, I will act without fear or without favour. Someone said to me, John, don't judge others for the lack of bravery and commitment shown. I do not see myself as brave. I see myself as a man who believes in protecting the vulnerable, doing God's work, and doing what my oath said, to act without fear or without favour. They are going against their oath. And I said, we will look at this word fear, shall we? What are they frightened of? Telling the truth. Where the real fear lies is this young child laying in a kid's home at night, and they're coming and they're taking the blankets from over him. That's the real fear. We need to get a grip. You come under attack, and you do come under attack, and it's painful and it hurts. And it does do its best to destroy you. Maggie Oliver said to me, John, I was going to prison. The CPS turned round and said, we've got enough evidence. If you don't come to some agreement, admit to whatever, then you're found guilty, you will go to prison. She had to tell her children she was going to prison. The CPS in the end with me turned around and said, John Wedger's mitigation was so powerful, we could never convict him. I said to them, I submitted my statement prior to any trial. I wrote a statement and I gave it to Crested Dick and said, here's my statement. Whatever you say I've done, I've done. I don't care. But I will not be tried by you. I will be tried in a Crown Court. And I will be tried by my peers and I will be tried fairly. I've done nothing wrong, and I listed every single person from the bottom right the way up to the top. Who was involved? Who knew about it? Who did nothing? Who then did nothing? Who did nothing? This went right up to Bernard Hogan Howe and now to Crested Dick. Bernard Hogan Howe knew about this. The campaign of bullying on me orchestrated under his command. He has now been appointed by the House of Lords to look into child grooming gangs and how they existed. Well, I might save him the trouble. I can do that for him. It is wrong there. Looking now, I was asked to make an address to Lord Pearson's office regarding the presence of grooming gangs and how it works, the mechanics of it all. They're looking at it from a very sort of religious background, that it's Muslim gangs. This is a bigger picture. This is a bigger picture. Kids are a commodity. And one of the things I want to refer back to is Mark Dutroux, whenever I give a talk, you have to make things relevant. We don't look at the third world and how they're dealing with things because there are different people. Let's look at what we got on our backyard. One of the countries that's demographically very similar to us is Belgium. In living memory, it went on in Belgium. And it went on with Mark Dutroux. And the kids that came forward were so pigeonholed in what they could talk about. Anything that went outside of Mark Dutroux, they weren't allowed. I think it was 23 to 25 civilian witnesses died in the lead up to the trial.
90.
Absolutely unbelievable, yep. And then the people took the power back. They blew the windows out with the fire engines of the parliamentary office. And then they sprayed horse manure all over the building and they took to the streets, didn't they? Half a million people.
Mm-hmm.
Half a million people. And what do? We only kick off when someone throws a cat in a wheelie bin. If we allow our children to be attacked and preyed on in this way, we have failed as a decent and moral society. And we are doing that. And we are doing nothing. It has to stop. And I don't want no glory, but people like myself, we need backing.
That's former DC John Wedger there speaking to the International Tribunal for Natural Justice. That's the ITNJ.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, we look now at one powerful arm of the Israel lobby, which began around the same time as the Zionist Project back in the late 1800s, the B'nai B'rith.
B'nai B'rith, the words mean sons of the covenant. It's Hebrew words. The B'nai B'rith was set up allegedly in 1843 in New York City by approximately 12 obscure Freemasons. The B'nai B'rith was quickly centered actually in Cincinnati in the 1850s. And its virtual sole preoccupation was a very small organization. By the time of the Civil War, it had about between 1,000 and 1,500 members in America. Its preoccupation was to build up the party that was trying to break up the United States. They ran various southern and northern, which were called Copperhead, political operations. And we've written a lot about this. I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail on that. But these people, even though most of the Jewish people in America were living in the north, especially after immigrants came in from Germany, and most of the Jewish people in the Civil War were pro-Union, the B'nai B'rith was entirely pro-Confederate. And many of its leaders were arrested by the United States as Confederate spies during the American Civil War, including the head of the B'nai B'rith operation in Washington, D.C., Simon Wolfe. He was arrested almost immediately upon coming to Washington by Lincoln, by the head of Lincoln's Secret Service. Later on, he was a close friend of John Wilkes Booth, and the day that Lincoln was assassinated, he went drinking with John Wilkes Booth, and they supposedly talked about John Wilkes Booth's personal problems, and a few hours later, Wilkes Booth killed Lincoln. This is a part of the British party in Freemasonry, the British faction in politics. And they're allied to other British operations. So you can't understand this without, again, going back to this question of Great Britain. Remember that we had a revolution against England. And then a generation later, that was in 1776. In 1812, we had another war against England, the Second War of Independence. They wanted to take the country back. We beat them in that war. Then there was a civil war later on, 1861. And the British supplied guns to the South. They wanted to break up the United States. They didn't want to have any free countries anywhere. They didn't want to have any strong nations anywhere. So they whipped up the Southerners to fight against the United States. They lost that. They didn't give up. In fact, they had more and more power as an empire. And they have these factions. Now, I was talking earlier about their faction among the Jews. The Jewish religion is a survival from ancient times. There's various complications to it, but it's essentially identified with the Old Testament. Well, these people are not religious. The B'nai B'rith is a social organization, a political organization, and the basis of the B'nai B'rith is a political manipulation of race. They have a committee called the Anti-Defamation League. That's a committee of this B'nai B'rith. In the 20th century, when this Anti-Defamation League has existed, they have specialized in saying in public that certain people were anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic. And they're very selective about this because they didn't participate during the time that Hitler was the dictator of Germany. They didn't participate in the movement against Hitler. They also participated in the Ku Klux Klan. They also blackmailed J. Edgar Hoover, who had certain sexual problems and certain personal problems. Gay Edgar Hoover. And you'll find that the gangsters who make up, I'll give you an example of one of these guys, Mo Dalitz. Morris Dalitz, D-A-L-I-T-Z, got the award from the B'nai B'rith, from the Anti-Defamation League. They call it the Torch of Liberty Award because he gave them a lot of money. But also because he's a Hollywood, he's an owner of Hollywood Productions. He is one of the He's the main corporate owner for Meyer Lansky in Las Vegas. He is one of the five or six chiefs of organized crime in America. There are other people like Kenneth Bialk and others. Organized crime of the Meyer Lansky faction, that is Jewish organized crime, is represented in the political world by this Anti-Defamation League. Now, what is their religion? See, this is where you get down to the brass tacks of the thing. In New York City, they had a chancellor of schools recently driven out of office by the voters and the parents because he was promoting something called the Rainbow Curriculum. Good liberal mishmash, right? Well, this Rainbow Curriculum promoted the idea that children should be taught to be comfortable with homosexuals, with adult homosexuals. And the parents thought this was not a good idea. A lot of the people promoting that were members of the North American Man-Boy Love Association, who were pederasts. The Anti-Defamation League fought for that curriculum, helped to produce that curriculum, and fought against the people who didn't like it, including Jews, Christians, and others in New York City. Now, what's the religious basis for them doing that? Well, you have to understand what they represent. In the real world, they represent what I've been talking about tonight. These are thugs representing this traditional party of criminal activities associated with the British Empire. You've had this throughout time immemorial. You've had people who are associated with crime and who would say that they have something to do with religion, but they represent something different than that. You cannot understand these things without studying their history. And you have to ask certain theological and other questions about them, certainly, but you have to see what they do in the real world. And they are the party of organized crime in the United States.
That's Anton Chaitkin there talking about the B'nai B'rith. And we're going to finish this evening by having a listen to a chap called Gilad Atzmon. He's a musician, jazz musician. He's actually, I spoke to him earlier this week from the United States. And what he's doing is he's bringing, I suppose, this whole business of anti-Semitism and accusations of such bang up to date by looking at the his take on the attacks on Ken Livingstone.
We are dealing with a catastrophic, vicious circle. The actions taken by Israel clearly lead to anti-Jewish feelings. So when people see Israel deploying snipers and drones and airplanes against unarmed civilians, protesters, killing them and injuring them on thousands, people are very upset. And since Israel defined itself as the Jewish state, some people are very upset with the Jews. Such developments make or can make Jews very insecure. What do? They consider making Aliyah, immigrating to Israel. And this is the cycle. The more brutal Israel is, the more Jews seek shelter in Israel, which is exactly the fundamental demand of the Zionist agenda, to make Israel into the home of the Jews. Now, the outcome is pretty devastating because, as we know, a lot of French Jews and British Jews and diaspora Jews in general have secured themselves a Holocaust shelter in Israel, in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem. These houses are basically standing there vacant, and Jewish Israelis cannot really find a roof in their own land. So they serve in the army, they commit all those atrocious crimes against humanity in the name of a vague concept, securing a home for diaspora Jews who don't even think practically of moving to Israel. They just keep it as a safe haven. And Israel definitely contribute to the rise of anti-Semitism. The devastating outcome is that Israel, bizarrely enough, benefits from such a rise.
Going back to 1933 and looking at what was going on in Nazi Germany, it did seem that some sort of deal was being done between the Zionists and the Nazis in order to get rid of the Jews in Nazi Germany and send them over to Palestine, if that was possible.
Yeah.
So what would you make of Ken Livingstone's comment that Hitler supported Zionism? Do you think that's justified?
Ken Livingstone was telling the absolute truth. There was an Avara agreement, or in English, transfer agreement, that was signed in 1933 between the National Socialist regime in Germany and the Zionist institutions that were operating in Palestine. There was no Israel yet. Thanks to this agreement, more than 60,000 Jews from Germany and Austria managed to make Aliyah or immigrate to Palestine, and by doing so, probably saved their life. So there were some inaccurate details in Livingstone's statement. For instance, he spoke about Israel, and it was actually Palestine at the time. But his statement is 100% right. Now, the fact that such a hero, a political hero, an anti-racist, brings disrepute on a party in Britain by telling the truth means that Britain has removed itself from the liberal, enlightened ethos. It's not a free country anymore. It's a tyranny of correctness that is defined by Jewish sensitivities. But there is a further question. Why are Jews allegedly offended by someone looking into their past, or even more precisely, telling the truth about their past? What is it about the Avara agreement, the transfer agreement, that is so painful for Jews to admit? This is the question that we have to ask. And if the Jews cannot admit to themselves that there was such an agreement, why can Livingstone or the Labour Party have to pay the price? I argue the Jewish power is the power to silence criticism of Jewish power. Ken Livingstone was critical of something that can be realized as Jewish politics in the early 30s. What do we do with him? Jewish power. We silence him. The same power is employed against the Labour Party. It is very clear that some Zionist bodies really don't like Jeremy Corbyn. A fundamental advantage of a free society is the ability to call a spade a spade. Now, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. But I can definitely see that less and less people can afford to do it, because calling a spade, talking, for instance, about a clear historical fact that is approved by every Jewish history text. There was a Avara agreement. More than 60,000 Jews, German Jews, Austrian Jews, were saved by this Avara agreement. The fact that we cannot really address these issues in Britain suggest to us that Britain nowadays is not the Britain you were raised in or the Britain I immigrated to. It changed into a very problematic state. While politicians are operating within a given recognized language game, we artists are there to bring along a new language game. We artists are there to reshape the future and ideally present a prospect of a better future that entails peace, harmony, reconciliation, and so on and so on. But it goes farther. When it comes to music, when it comes to art, you just cannot lie. I cannot write a bad tune and convince you or force you to like it. I have to write a piece of melody that genuinely makes you cry or jolly or optimistic. This is the biggest power of aesthetics. This is the biggest power of music, especially music, because we are really dealing with an abstract language. This proximity to truthfulness makes musicians at large into people who can deliver the truth about Palestine. Now, let's make sure that everybody knows supporting Palestine can cost you your career. The music business worldwide is at large dominated by Jewish businessmen. Not only, but they are definitely by far overrepresented, especially in America. They are very forceful, and they are mounting huge pressures on artists that express their views. I think that even Roger Waters, despite his strengths, could feel it in the last year when they tried to pull out some of his concerts, and we are talking about arenas. I've seen some concerts of mine being canceled in the past. It didn't happen for a while now, but we are dealing with a very powerful lobby. They managed to expel thousands of people from 1,000 labor members. We can imagine that they succeed in pulling one jazz gig a year or there. Roger Waters is very dedicated to this cause because he was there. He was in Palestine. And it touched his heart. I'm not an activist. I'm doing it because I'm fascinated by issues to do with Jewishness ideologically, culturally. I can see how dominant Jewish culture is. In my recent book, Being in Time, I speak about the dominance of Jerusalem over Athens and the way I differentiate between the two. Athens is the birthplace of philosophy, of truthfulness. Jerusalem is the birthplace of obedience, litigation, rules, correctness. We are living in a Jerusalemite tyranny of correctness. The question that we have to ask ourselves is, what is it about Jerusalem that is so dominant, that its survival ability is seemingly stronger than Athens? And how do we bring Athens back? And I think that in terms of bringing Athens back, Roger Waters is a great force. He's not the only one. I see myself as a dedicated advocate of Athenian thinking. And I do want to believe that the Brits will find their way back.
What Gilad is saying there, Martin, is that there's an immense, powerful Israel lobby there. That's Gilad Atzmon. But he says there Britain is not a free country anymore and things can happen to Ken Livingstone like they have.
Well, I mean, I think Ken Livingstone would probably agree. And don't forget, he was kicked out of the Labour Party before and he kicked his way back in. And the GLC was abolished to get rid of him.
There is a meeting, you know, isn't there, on Monday?
There's been a thought on my side.
Meeting on Monday, Corbyn, Anti-Semitism and Justice for Palestine. It's on Monday at 7 p.m. at the Arc Bar, which is 27 Broad Street. All sorts of people speaking there, which include the National Union of Teachers and Salma Yaqub.
Yeah, and there's also a spokesperson there from the Jewish Voice for Labour. So, you know, the idea that we're anti-Semites is rubbish.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 6. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
one of the most important moments and underappreciated moments in our national life, when our whole our language was kind of purged of a whole set of concepts and images and categories that earlier in American life had been fairly commonplace. The notion today that you would call anybody who gets a wage for his work, which most of us do, a wage slave is unthinkable. But 125, as you say, years ago, it was commonplace.
A conversation on the history of class consciousness in the United States. Our guest is Stephen Frazier, a historian and author of the book Class Matters, The Strange Career of an American Delusion. Then later, as any day now, the Supreme Court is expected to rule on President Trump's travel ban. We'll explore how the court has viewed the role of animus, meaning motivated by ill will, in the law. We'll air an interview with law professor William Ariza. He's the author of the book Animus, a short introduction to bias in the law. That's next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. House Republicans are debating two immigration bills, one more hardline than the other, but both opposed by immigrants' rights groups and Democrats. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan all but acknowledged that neither bill may pass, but he said the votes would give Republicans the opportunity to express themselves on the issue.
But a lot of our members want to be able to express themselves by voting for the policies that they like so that they can express their votes on the floor. And what the president helped us do this week is he answered the questions members had, which is, are these bills that are coming to the floor bills that if it made it to his desk, he would sign them into law? If these bills do not pass today, then we will cross that bridge when we get to it. But the last thing I want to do right now is undercut the votes that we're about to have.
House Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said Paul Ryan's measure, the less hardline bill often referred to as the compromise, is no compromise at all.
Both do absolutely nothing to solve the heartbreaking and horrific situation for children on the border. According to the Conference of Catholic Bishops, both bills perpetuate child detention and undermine existing protections relating to such detentions. Catholic Conference of Bishops. Both of these bills fail to provide a permanent legislative fix for our dreamers, selling out their American dream to build the president's obscene border wall. Both are loaded full of every anti-immigrant provision imaginable, dismantling legal family immigration.
House debate takes place a day after Trump tried to tamp down the growing outrage over the separation of immigrant parents and children with a three-page executive order reversing his administration's policy. Trump this morning praised the conditions under which the separated immigrant children were being held.
We have a situation where some of these places, they're really running them well, and I give a lot of credit to Secretary Nielsen and all of the people that have worked. It's the nicest that people have seen, but it's still something that shouldn't be taking place. My wife, our First Lady, is down now at the border.
Trump's order says nothing about reuniting the at least 2,300 children who've been separated from their parents. Immigrant children as young as 14 housed at a juvenile detention center in Virginia say they were beaten while handcuffed and locked up for long periods in solitary confinement, left nude and shivering in concrete cells. The abuse claims against the Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center in Virginia are detailed in federal court filings that include a half dozen sworn statements from teens jailed there for months or years. Multiple detainees say the guards stripped them of their clothing and strapped them to chairs with bags placed over their heads. A former child development specialist who worked there said she saw teens with bruises and broken bones. The center's lawyers deny the abuse allegations. House Republicans introduced their 2019 budget proposal that includes $5.4 trillion in cuts to domestic spending. That includes a $537 billion cut to Medicare, $1.5 trillion in cuts to Medicaid, $4 billion in reductions to Social Security over the next decade, largely to pay for the Republican tax overhaul that reduces taxes largely for the wealthy and corporations. The Republican budget is no surprise to Democrats who have warned since the Republican tax cuts that the party would next try to cut social safety net spending to close a nearly $21 trillion deficit. In East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, hundreds of people took to the streets to protest the fatal police shooting of an unarmed 17-year-old killed just seconds after he fled a traffic stop.
What did you see last night? A murder last night, and we want answers for that.
Antoine Rose was shot three times by an officer who'd been sworn in just hours earlier and was working his first shift with the East Pittsburgh Police Department, although he had served as an officer elsewhere for 8 years. The African-American teen was a passenger in a car that police had stopped because it matched the description of a vehicle being sought in a non-fatal shooting in a nearby community. Hundreds of Yemeni men held without trial in secret prisons run by the United Arab Emirates are being subjected to sexual abuse in southern Yemen. From inside one of the prisons, detainees smuggled letters and drawings detailing the horrors of mass sexual abuse and humiliation at the hands of Emirati officers. The U.S. is a key ally of the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, who've been fighting Houthi rebels in Yemen. The U.S. provides targeting guidance and in-air refueling for Saudi coalition warplanes, which have carried out airstrikes on weddings, hospitals, schools, and markets in Yemen. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. We begin today with a discussion on economic class in the United States and our changing views on it, from violent worker revolts from more than 100 years ago to a sense, or at least what our guest calls perhaps a delusion, of having no distinction of class in public life at all. Our guest is Steve Frazier. Steve Frazier is a historian and author of the book Class Matters, The Strange Career of an American Delusion. Steve Frazier, good to have you back on this program.
thank you very much for having me back.
It's interesting, especially when you think about it, and hardly do we ever think about it, maybe that's your point, that we're not really conscious of class very often in American society.
That's correct. That's the premise of the book. And although there have been moments in American history where the consciousness of class has been more acute and visible, most of America and the American myth is devoted to the belief that class doesn't really matter very much, if at all. And that's a kind of founding credo going all the way back to colonial days and so on, that we're a country almost uniquely, maybe uniquely, immune to the kinds of class divisions and conflicts that are quite common and have always been common in Western Europe and so on, but that somehow the settlers who settled here in this abundant new world managed to, both because of that abundance of natural resources and so on, and because of their kind of political genius, were able to establish a society either free of classes or one in which, if classes did exist, they were quickly going out of existence. And a lot of my book sort of talks about, you know, it's easy to disprove that myth by citing episodes of, and which America is full of very violent class conflict, especially in the 19th century and through into the Great Depression and so on, when the labor movement was insurgent and that kind of thing. But my book, rather than talking about those particular moments, which most people think of as exceptional to the American story of equality and classlessness, I look at those moments where they're critical to the American myth, the colonial, the founding of the country at Jamestown and Plymouth, the adoption of the U.S. Constitution, the myth of the cowboy, the erection of the Statue of Liberty, the I Have a Dream speech. All of these are moments which seem to be testimony to the classlessness of American life. And I explore those moments in order to excavate the class realities that are hidden beneath them and that we have almost made an occupation of denying.
And I want to get into those historic moments. Let me ask you this. Do we try to hide class today? And I ask that because I think I'm very aware that we do have classes here. I feel like I am a part of a class here in the United States. Yet when I travel abroad, oftentimes I feel like it's more visible other places I go.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to England, for example, people are acutely conscious of the finest gradations of social hierarchy in British society. And this is generally true throughout, certainly Western Europe, and not just Western Europe, Europe. It is just far, far less true here, because we are invested in the notion that this is the land of freedom and equality, where all men are created equal, to coin a phrase, and we're not conscious of those kinds of class divisions, because we've established a society, both because it's a rich society, so that therefore the kinds of instances of poverty and squalor and exploitation and oppression that seem fairly commonplace elsewhere have been avoided here. Thanks to the abundance of the American economy. There's a book written many years ago by a famous historian called People of Plenty, which says that America has been able to submerge the realities of class conflict in a kind of ocean of abundance. And certainly the consumer economy and mass consumer culture today helps to do that. I will say, though, however, recently, and actually there are recent elections, most poignantly, have once again raised the specter of class in American life. I begin my book by talking about Trump's remarkable, completely unanticipated victory, and the fact that many people attribute that, and partly rightly, partly wrongly, but to the disaffection of a white, particularly white working class. But not only Trump, but Sanders too appealed to a kind of populist impulse from the left, Trump from the right, that reminded people that indeed we do live in a society of the 1% and the 99%. Occupy Wall Street, of course, before Sanders and Trump reminded us of that. So we are living in a moment in American history, which doesn't happen often, in which we're becoming a little bit more conscious that we do have serious class divisions.
But you would argue throughout our entire history as a nation, we go in and out of that consciousness.
Yes, exactly. For instance, take a very unlikely example. The cowboy is one of our favorite American myths. He's the epitome of kind of self-reliant individualism, which is what America is supposed to be all about. And yet the cowboy was, in when he was flourishing in the mid and late 19th century, on those long cattle drives, was a kind of rural proletarian. He was rootless. He enjoyed a kind of precarious living. He lived an incredibly harsh life. He was often dispossessed from farms and small ranches that he might have once owned by the giant ranches that began to flourish in the West, some of them owned by British investors or East Coast investors. He lived an extremely difficult life, very dangerous, full of accidents, no security, finished a cattle drive, had no work after that cattle drive unless he could hook on with another. So he's a kind of rural proletarian, but we have our culture has sort of transmogrified him into this kind of self-reliant, very masculine, heroic figure who needs nobody, is completely independent, and so on. And we in a way, he is. That cowboy stands for all of us, for something that is presumably at the core of what we believe America is all about.
So I think of a time when class consciousness was very strong, and I guess a little more than 120 years ago, maybe a little more than that, if you think of everything from the rise of the labor movement, the Haymarket incident of 1886 in Chicago, and these type of things. And what I was going to originally, what I was originally thinking as I was preparing for a conversation is, well, maybe it was the Cold War during the in the Red Scare that took class.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think that's one of the most important moments and underappreciated moments in our national life, when our whole our language was kind of purged of a whole set of concepts and images and categories that, as you note, earlier in American life had been fairly commonplace. The notion today that you would call anybody who gets a wage for his work, which we most of us do, a wage slave is unthinkable. But 125, as you say, years ago, it was commonplace. Yeah. Because people had, for the first time, confronted capitalism, and that capitalism left people dependent on the diminishing number of people who owned capital in order to actually live. And so the notion that they were enslaved to capital was not something that simply anarchists and socialists talked about, but was common, was commonplace, and infused movements like the ones you're talking about, the populist movement, the labor movement, the antitrust movement, and so on. And the Cold War, when, of course, communism becomes our great enemy, is really more directed, quite frankly, for most people, it's more a domestic war than it really is a foreign war. It's a way, after all, America had just come out of the New Deal era in which class consciousness was inflamed. Yeah. There was this enormous, powerful labor movement. The Democratic Party had been transformed internally into a party that was much more open to the needs of ordinary working people. You had a president who talked about economic royalists, talked about how rich in his Roosevelt's 1936 campaign, he talks about how he knows the rich hate him, and he welcomes their hatred. This was unprecedented in American history. So we come out of that period of intense class consciousness and conflict, and then we confront the Soviet Union at the end of World War II, and anti-communism, which had always been part of the American cultural atmosphere, becomes so powerful in the Cold War that all kinds of movements, which are even the most far from communist movements, civil rights, for example, or free speech, or, you know, the kinds of literature we're allowed in our libraries, or actors in Hollywood, all of them become, or Hollywood movies, become tainted with, and we're no longer allowed to say a lot of things which Americans used to be talk about exploitation, oppression, wage slavery, class conflict, plutocracy, oligarchy, barons, you know, robber barons. This was part of our language, and then it ceased to be because of this culture of fear, this Cold War fear and intimidation. And when you lose those categories and those images, you know, there's a philosopher who once said, grammar is the house of being. Well, when you lose those kinds of, they're not exactly grammar, but you get my point, those kind of linguistic tools, you become homeless. You don't know any longer how to formulate and articulate the kind of class divisions. And then, of course, one of the chapters in my book is about, I don't know if your listeners will know this or not, but about the kitchen debate. At the time, it was a very, very famous moment in the Cold War. Richard Nixon, who was then vice president in 1959, faced off against the Soviet premier Nikita Khrushchev in a kitchen in a model ranch house in Moscow at the American exhibit of a world fair. And it's a fascinating moment in American history, because what Nixon argues to Khrushchev is that it's America. He doesn't say this, of course, you'll realize in a moment. It's America who's achieved communism. What he means is that there are no more classes in America because we're such an affluent society. Remember, this is the moment of the, you know, John Kenneth Galbraith's famous book, The Affluent Society.
Yeah.
This is that moment in American life. And Nixon says, see, we have no more classes here. We all can afford ranch houses and automobiles and the modern conveniences, you know, fancy stoves and appliances and dishwashers and so on and so forth. So we have triumphed where you haven't, we have. And therefore, there's no need to talk about classes in America anymore, as maybe we did 25 years ago during the New Deal. Those days are done because of this new this kind of consumer cornucopia, and that was his argument to Khrushchev, and Khrushchev argued back. But it's just, the kitchen debate is a quite a ironic moment in American history, and a time that indicates why we, for a long time afterwards, couldn't talk about class.
That's interesting. You anticipated my next question, because I was on the kitchen debate, and as you said, if people were aware of it or not, when this occurred, it predates me slightly, before I was even born. But I'm not a historian, but certainly a history enthusiast. And this was the first time I actually heard of the kitchen debate.
Is that right?
Yeah.
No kidding. Well, I'm glad I wrote about it, because I was old enough to be around, although I was a little boy, but I remembered it. And I remembered it because it was covered in every newspaper. Nixon was considered the victor, at least in America. He was considered the victor in the debate. It probably propelled him into becoming at least the Republican candidate. He lost in 1960 for president. And what's ironic about it is that Nixon had built his whole career as a California politician, eventually as a senator and then vice president, on anti-communism. He was the second coming of Joseph McCarthy during the McCarthy period. That's how he defeated his rivals in California politics. And here he was talking about how America had become this classless utopia. So it's a wonderful moment if you're historically inclined, or even if you're not.
It could be just a big oversight on my behalf there. We are in conversation with Steve Frazier. Steve Frazier is a historian, and he's authored a number of books. His latest is called Class Matters, The Strange Career of an American Delusion. Why include the Martin Luther King Jr. I Have a Dream speech?
Well, you know, it's funny. The I Have a Dream speech happens at a moment of intense combativeness in American life. It's about race, and finally, American apartheid is being challenged. And King makes this speech, which is probably, next to the Gettysburg Address, the most celebrated speech in American history. Today, everybody subscribes. I mean, Rush Limbaugh would line up and say, yeah, I like that speech. Everybody.
Yeah.
Then, when it was first announced, it seemed a call to arms against American apartheid. What happens to that speech, and the reason it becomes so universally acclaimed, is that a movement, a civil rights movement, which earlier, before the speech in 63, had been closely tied to the labor movement and assumed that the liberation of black people would happen in concert with the liberation or the the struggle for reform and social justice among working people generally. You know, the first let me put it this way: the notion that you could achieve social justice, freedom, and emancipation used to be viewed, certainly during the New Deal years, both by black activists and white working class activists, as a matter of contending against not constitutional obstacles to that, but to the power latent in the distribution of property and property rights, and challenging the autocracy of industrialists and corporations and their power to dictate lives to people. After the King's Speech says one great thing. It says we have to end the system of apartheid and establish formal equality. It was thought that formal equality would somehow also produce substantive equality. And for some people, it did. It's one of the great historic moments in American life. I participated in that. I was part of what was called, I don't know if your listeners will know this either, but something called Mississippi Freedom Summer, where a bunch of white, 1,000 northern student volunteers went down to Mississippi, which was the most god-awful state in the Union, and fought to have for the right for black people to register to vote. Anyway, it's an important moment in American civil rights history. And it was thought that you achieve the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and you make reality out of what had been the 14th and 15th Amendments, but had been disregarded in the South for 100 years, and that would produce real equality. It turned out, however, not to be the case. It did for some. It allowed people, upwardly mobile African Americans, to move into better jobs, into colleges, all a whole range of social opportunities which had been denied them. But King himself realized before his death that it wasn't enough. That's why the Poor People's Campaign he launched just before his death, and in many other activities he was engaged in those days, were directed at economic democracy as well as formal political equality. Because without the economic democracy, formal political equality for the masses of African Americans, and others for that matter, became a kind of empty promise. And you have, King says, look, in the North, African Americans can vote. The question is, what can they vote for? What do they get out of voting? And so long as the structures of power in the economy remain the way they are, there'll be little to vote for. So what happens is that speech becomes an evasion. It doesn't begin that way, but it becomes, over the course of time, an evasion that even Rush Limbaugh and types like that can subscribe to, because, well, we're a perfect society. We have the Civil Rights Act. We have the Voting Rights Act. Everybody's equal. So what's the problem? Well, the problem is, and this is not just a problem of African Americans, is chronic, wide-scale poverty and exploitation at work, which the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and a whole slew of Equal Opportunity Acts cannot address. You have to address the sources of power in the economy to address that.
Does somebody like A. Philip Randolph then have
A. Philip Randolph was, of course, I shouldn't say of course, he was a very well-known labor leader and civil rights activist. He founded and led a black union called the Sleeping Car Porters Union, originally at the Pullman Company. He is both a labor and civil rights activist who, at the early stages of World War II, threatens to hold a march on Washington unless the federal government opens up the armed forces to black soldiers, integrates them, and demands that employment discrimination cease by all those corporations that are feeding off the government, getting wartime, you know, federal contracts. And the threat of that march, it never happens, but the threat of that march caused FDR to form what's called the Fair Employment Practices Commission, which began the long road of opening up opportunities for black folks. Well, Randolph is one of the organizers of the March on Washington. He's one of the key people involved with King and Southern Christian Leadership Conference and others in organizing that march. And Randolph had always known that the labor question and the race question were linked and could only be solved together, not apart from each other. Of course, there are two ways to look at that. You know, racism, which is a kind of class consciousness itself. It's the one that Trump uses. That is to say, when he appeals through xenophobia or just outright racism to a kind of white working class base, to the degree that those people are attracted to him, what he's doing is taking their disaffection, their anger at, the bailout of giant banks and so on, which they are angry about, the fact that their jobs have been disappearing abroad for decades, the fact that half the country's been deindustrialized and turned into ghost towns. These are real things that have happened to people. What you do is you add a tincture of race or xenophobia to that class consciousness, and you get Trump or characters like Trump. So these issues are always linked. The question is, how do you link them in a healthy way, which is what Randolph and others, and King, in the final years of his life, was trying to do.
Speaking of Donald Trump, and as a historian, you meaning Donald Trump, but as Mr. Fraser, you being a historian, and thinking about Donald Trump here, and I oftentimes am baffled in trying to find historical precedents for what we're experiencing now. Are you able to put this presidency in some type of historic context?
Well, no. The blunt answer, I can compare him to one character in American life who didn't become president but wanted to be and is very much like him, and yet distinctly different in a way that I think is instructive. William Randolph Hearst was, of course, a famous newspaper publisher. The Hearst publishing empire covered the country. Hearst was a very politically ambitious man. He wanted to be president, thought he could be, ran for governor of New York, ran for various congressional offices, nearly became the mayor of New York. He was, just like Trump, the inheritor, not the founder, but the inheritor of family wealth. He had enormous power over the media directly. Trump has power over the media because he's a spectacle, so the media salivates when he shows up. Had that kind of power. And both men, Hearst and Trump, were populists, but populists of a very distinctly different variety. Hearst was a demagogue and an anti-Semite, but he also took for granted, because he's living around sort of 1900, 1910, 1920, that this is a country where there's a lot of left-wing populist sentiment afield. He supported unions. He supported the antitrust movement. He was friendly to immigrants, right? That's where he thought he could build his base, even though he was demagogic about what he really intended. Trump, so that's what I would call a left-wing version of the kind of populism that Trump is championing from the right, and with his appeals to super masculinity and anti-immigrant feelings and racial feelings and all this kind of stuff. It's also a populism, but a kind of right-wing populism, which of course is not unique to the United States. We see it all over Europe now, in very, very Hungary and Poland and France and so on. It means that the center is kind of not holding this kind a neoliberal center that has kind of governed our lives here and in Europe for the last, 30, 40 years is fracturing. And the Sanders and Trump campaigns were signs of that fracturing.
That's really interesting to me, because whenever I've asked other people that question, and when I asked you that, I was not expecting you to say Hearst. Mm-hmm. And everyone else who makes a similar comparison always brings up Huey Long, the former governor of Louisiana.
I disagree with that, because Long, also a demagogue, these guys are all demagogues, they belong to that tribe, but Long in his Share the Wealth campaign was addressing just what Roosevelt was addressing. He was not a racist. He was talking about the maldistribution of wealth, first in Louisiana and then in America generally. He had some cockamamie schemes about how that could be solved. But the point is, his animus was directed against concentrated wealth, big corporations, the oil companies in Louisiana, and so on and so forth, in a way that Trump doesn't begin to do. He's a plutocrat, and in the end, it's not hard to tell, although every once in a while he says, I'm for the working man, blah, blah, blah. He is such a He is what he is. He's a billionaire, I guess. We'll never know, I guess. But anyway, he's a purported billionaire, and he makes no bones about the fact that he loves the business class. He may particularly not like this corporation or that corporation, but he what we're supposed to love about him is that he's a successful billionaire, that he knows how to do a deal. Huey Long would never say anything like that. Never. It would kill him. So, you know, I don't want to make a hero out of Huey Long, but I don't think Huey Long's like Trump. Trump is really a kind of plutocratic populist, and I don't think Long was that. I do think Hearst was that, but because the context within which he lived was so different, his populist demagoguery went in a different direction.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I never felt entirely comfortable making the comparison to Huey Long.
Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah, I guess people might also cite Father Coughlin, who lived during that same time, the radio broadcaster. Yeah, the famous radio broadcaster, who was enormously popular and also anti-capitalist, but much more also anti-Semitic. You know, believing in all these kinds of Jewish conspiracies to take over the world and the economy, and much more a kind of fascist in the making than I think Huey Long was. I mean, Huey Long was a dictator. There's no question about that. He ran Louisiana politics as if it was his own fiefdom. Created a lot of enemies, but I don't think he belongs in that comparison.
How about our conception of class? You're making an argument here that once again we are recognizing class, and it's also being not just from the left but from the right as well. Have we had this kind of, if we think of the Trump voters and people that are voting for somebody like Trump, have we had that kind of class consciousness before?
Let me make sure I understand what you're asking me.
Conservative right wing view of class.
A conservative right-wing view? No, I don't think we've had that much. There have been trends in right-wing intellectual circles that may have offered that up as a kind of critique of American society. But as a mass movement, I don't think I'll take that back. We've had some more recently. If you look at the 19th century, I don't really think so. I mean, a case maybe might be made about the nativist movement in the antebellum period, what was called the Know-Nothing movement. I think the thing that the movement that strikes me as coming close is the Klan, when the Klan was a mass movement. Now, people probably don't know, maybe your listeners don't realize, that in the 1920s, the Klan had millions of members. It elected all kinds of congressmen. It influenced all kinds of state legislatures from the East Coast to the West Coast and the Midwest. This was a anti-Catholic, anti-Semitic, anti-black movement with enormous power for a while. It didn't last very long, but for several years it was a real political, it carried real political weight in various parts of the United States, and evinced a kind of anti-capitalism. You know, it was against the big boys who ran things, you know, the establishment, the urban elites. You know, it was mainly a rural-based movement, although not entirely, so it had an animus directed against the cosmopolitan elites running things in the big metropolitan centers, and so that was a kind of right wing populist.
This is the second iteration of the Klan. This is when they're trading in their robes for suits and cross burnings for picnics and fairs.
Yes, I think there is a lot to be said for that. I think that. That it is a kind of second coming of that kind of movement, and it comes, however, under very different circumstances. Then in the 20s, you know, what is happening is it's a kind of rural America that feels utterly bypassed and offended culturally in a way that's in that way very similar to today, the kind of cultural sense of cultural affront that people in the right wing movement have, that, you know, the centers of culture are antithetical to their values, their family values, and so on. But it was a prosperous time. I think what accounts for a good bit of the right, not all of it, but some of the right-wing populism we feel, we sense today, is this long epic where the heartland, the homeland, we call it, or the heartland of the homeland, was kind of eaten alive, was deindustrialized. You had financial capitalism basically strip mining American industry. I'm talking about the era of the 80s and 90s, leverage buyouts, et cetera, and so forth, mergers and acquisitions, where all kinds of manufacturing companies were stripped bare of their assets were sold off, whole industries declined or died entirely, jobs were shipped abroad, to the global south where wages were low and so on. So the kind of, silent majority, Nixon calls it in 1968, 1972, that world has suffered a long decline and is acutely sensitive to its decline, its cultural decline as the arbiters of the nation's values, but also its material decline. I think that's a little different than what happened in the 20s. I don't mean to say that entirely accounts for the right-wing populism today. Some of it is fed by quite prosperous folk, these kind of entrepreneurial. The other thing we've had happen today, the last 25 years or so, is the rebirth of family capitalism. Orange County, which was one of the founders of the conservative movement, is very wealthy, full of aspiring entrepreneurs, real estate developers, well-paid aeronautical engineers, high-tech people, land developers, real estate operators, et cetera, whose corporate America made its peace, uneasy peace, with kind of big government. The self-reliant entrepreneurial type didn't like that. Didn't like the intrusion of government, its regulations, et cetera, and so forth. And Goldwater, for example, who's after all a kind of ancestor of what we now think of as right-wing populism, had his base in places like Orange County, which were not impoverished by any means. They were up and coming places, but they were family. They were entranced by the ideals of family capitalism, self-reliance, self-invention. Albeit Orange County wouldn't exist without state and federal. It wouldn't exist in its current form without huge investments by the federal government and state governments in roads, in flood control, in irrigation, in aerospace, and so on. So that you turn a blind eye to, and you think, "Oh, I did this all myself," which they do. They think that, and they think therefore I don't need the government, and everybody should shift for themselves, and we can do away with the safety net, and so on.
The irony of it all.
Yeah.
Steve Frazier has been our guest. Again, Steve Frazier is a historian and he is the author of the book, Class Matters, The Strange Career of an American Delusion. Steve Frazier, that was fun. I thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. Bye-bye.
And you're listening to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Any day now, and perhaps even tomorrow, the Supreme Court will announce its ruling on President Donald Trump's controversial travel ban. Well, some time ago, we did what I thought was quite a fascinating conversation with William Ariza about what the role of animus has in the law. Animus meaning ill will towards certain people, and hence that influences or even drives what type of policies we have that could affect those people. And the Supreme Court has developed a way of looking at animus in the law through a number of cases during the 1990s that dealt with gay and lesbian rights. And usually these cases were in which they were upholding the rights for gays and lesbians were written by Justice Anthony Kennedy. And so it'll be very interesting and important to watch how Anthony Kennedy goes with this travel ban and see if they apply the standards of those cases in the 1990s will be applied in this case as well. So we're going to bring you a conversation to help prep for this very issue that we did with William Ariza. William Ariza is a Brooklyn Law School professor and author of the book Animus, A Short Introduction into Bias in the Law. And when the decision comes out, we're going to have Professor Ariza rejoin us again live the day that this decision comes out to be able to get more into this issue and find out exactly how did the court go. But in order to prepare for that, here's our conversation we had with William Ariza. William D. Ariza, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Thank you.
Maybe you can expand on the definition of animus.
Sure. Animus has a common sense lay definition, essentially dislike. So government action that is based in or grounded on dislike of a particular group, that would be something that in lay terms we could describe as animus or an action based in animus. The difficulty is that translating that common sense understanding of the term into legally workable doctrine is tricky. And so the book attempts to do that work of translation in a way that nevertheless can speak to the layperson, again, given, as you said, the timeliness of the topic, the lay resonance of the idea of animus. The book attempts to speak to a lay audience about what this really important legal concept really means.
And maybe to help illuminate the word animus a little bit more, you can look at the etymology behind the word. In Latin, animus is soul. Now, it wasn't always seen as such to have negative intent. It just meant soul at one point. But then if you look at also English language, which we're talking in, there's a connection to the word animosity. So sort of put those two together.
Yes. So when you think about it, anima or soul, as you suggested, you know, suggests something visceral, something deep, not necessarily something rational. And so, in fact, animus really, at the end of the day, boils down to an irrational, visceral dislike of a particular group. And of course, as we've been seeing in the news, the claims being made against the Trump executive orders is that they're based on that irrational, visceral dislike of Muslims.
And let's step back all the way to the Constitutional Convention of 1787. Much of our legal philosophy comes from the English law, old English law. Was animus really considered before the Constitution in 1787?
Well, not in so many words, but what I argue in the book is that if you look a little carefully and you scratch a little, you can, in fact, find connections between the modern concept of animus and ideas that were percolating in America in 1787. So very, very briefly, the decade between independence in 1776 and the Constitutional Convention in 1787 was a period in which state legislatures had an enormous amount of power. Colonial governors had left the scene, replaced by very weak state governors. Courts were generally thought of as, you know, a distinctly subordinate government institution, subordinate to legislatures. State legislatures were the main power in every state. And what framers like James Madison observed from a decade, from the perspective of 1787, looking back a decade, what they observed was that state legislatures were, in fact, deeply involved in favoring their friends and disfavoring their enemies. So whichever faction, whichever faction won the previous election and was in control of the legislature was busy enriching itself and harming its enemies, even though those actions weren't calculated to promote the public good. If you scratch hard enough, you can find a connection between Madison's concern with that kind of conduct and the modern idea of animus.
I mean, there's this fear of factionalism by the founders. There's this fear of party politics.
Absolutely. And there was a conception and a deep hope that American politics after independence would be marked by a spirit of virtue, and that government officials would be seeking to promote the public's interest, the general interest, rather than the interests of their particular class or their particular religious sect or their particular economic interest. There was that really deep hope that democracy would, in fact, bring out the better angels of our nature, to use Madison's terms again. As it turned out, the decade that he witnessed from the perspective of 1787 was full of party politics, factional politics, self-enrichment, and that's what the Constitution sought to
in part, that's what the Constitution sought to tamp down.
And the fear that, and what the fear is, isn't necessarily that, well, we get this Democratic and Republican Party system that we would recognize today. The system actually, the fear was actually that one faction would hijack the entire system for its own benefit.
That's exactly right. So forget about the public good, the theory went. Because we, this one faction, are in power, let's just grab all the goodies for ourselves. Let's grab all the power, all the wealth. Let's pass laws for our benefit. And let's be clear, these laws were really quite bald attempts to redistribute wealth or power as between the, you know, the dominant faction and the faction that was in the descendants at the time. Things like this. Legislatures would enact laws that actually reverse particular judicial decisions that were made that were contrary to that particular faction's interest. Legislatures would pass laws that were extremely friendly either to creditors in a state, if in fact the creditor interest was the one in power, or to debtors, if the debtor interest was the one in power. The Revolutionary Era was one in which one of the main fault lines was, are you a financier type, are you a merchant type, or are you a farmer or small artisan type? And that really tracked the creditor-debtor distinction, and factions were, legislatures were busy favoring one faction or the other, again, to the detriment of what was considered to be the general good.
Did the original Constitution, before we get to the 14th Amendment, which is mm-hmm. important in this conversation, but did the original yeah. Constitution then address that fear of factionalism?
Only partially. So when the Constitution created the federal government, of course, as we all know, it separated power out between the three branches, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. The hope there was that no one faction would be able to grab the reins of power of all three branches at the same time. Of course, that's the notion of checks and balances that we've all grew up learning. But that notion was, in fact, grounded in a fear of faction. So that's the first thing that the Constitution did. The second thing that the Constitution did was it tried to centralize power in the federal government for the most important issues, in particular, the power to regulate interstate commerce. The theory there was that if the most important powers, such as the commerce power, were lodged in the federal government, any particular faction would not have the wherewithal to exert a lot of control over that important power, because the nation was simply too large for one faction to be thought to be able to become a dominant majority over the entire nation. And finally, what the Constitution did was it instituted a series of relatively smallish, discrete restrictions on states. For example, restrictions on states passing laws that impaired the obligation of contracts, what we call the Contracts Clause. Prohibitions on states passing after the fact or ex post facto laws. And the thought was that that sort of targeted legislation was particularly susceptible to factional influence, and the original Constitution attempted to restrict states from engaging in that sort of targeted legislating.
Again, we are in conversation with William D. Ariza. He is Vice Dean and Professor of Law at Brooklyn Law School. He's the author of the book Animus, A Short Introduction to Bias in the Law. When did the idea or even the term itself, animus, start being used in deciding cases around discrimination? And not just discrimination, but hostility towards a group.
Yeah, so there were scattered references to the word animus starting, I think, in the 60s and 70s in religion clause cases in particular. And so essentially these cases said effectively, we may not know what the Establishment Clause requires. We may not know what the Free Exercise requires completely. But one thing everyone agrees on, these statements went, is that government cannot act based on a hostility toward a particular religion. So you started to see those statements being made in the religion clause context, of course, very resonant for the Trump, you know, for the Trump litigation, because it's the Establishment Clause that is providing a lot of the constitutional hook for the challenges to the executive orders. In terms of equality law, though, animus makes its first real appearance in the 1980s in a case called City of Cleburne versus Cleburne Living Center. This was a case dealing with the city's decision to not allow a home for intellectually disabled people to be located in a residential neighborhood. Essentially, the court decides that that decision was based on what the court described as the irrational prejudice and fear that the that the neighbors had of that group home. They didn't use the word animus per se, but Cleburne has become understood as really one of the foundational animus equal protection cases that later courts have relied on.
Well, when did animus, the word, first come?
So in the equality context, animus makes its first appearance, I believe, in 1996, relatively late, in a case called Romer versus Evans. So Romer was a case dealing with Colorado's Amendment 2, which was a constitutional amendment changing the Colorado Constitution to, among other things, prevent subdivisions of Colorado government, the University of Colorado, the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, the City of Boulder, that would prevent those subdivisions from granting protected status.
That's right. They were protecting, gays and lesbians from discrimination. Yeah. And then there was, a voter initiative trying to undo that? We've seen that before.
Oh, well. So Amendment 2 was itself a voter initiative. And indeed, during the 1990s, during the culture wars of the 1990s, we saw a number of initiatives that were proposed and indeed successfully enacted, both by cities and states across the country. Very often what would happen, and this is what happened in Colorado, is that cities or state institutions like a university system would institute a non-discrimination policy that included gays and lesbians, and then there would be a popular movement to overturn that by means of a referendum. That's exactly what Amendment 2 did.
I do want to go back in our remaining time here, back to this 1996 case, there are further cases along this line. Again, we started talking about Justice Anthony Kennedy. I believe he wrote the decision in Romer versus Evans, the 1996 case.
That's absolutely correct.
As he would write many decisions concerning the rights and protections, and also concerning marriage for gays and lesbians. And this will be very interesting when we see how Kennedy acts later on this year. But part of Kennedy's whole legacy is based on this argument of animus.
Yes, I think that's quite an accurate statement. I think when people look back on Justice Kennedy's legacy, one of the things that they will identify is that he excavated this idea of animus. He put it out there in Romer. He developed it in the Windsor case, which was the Defense of Marriage Act case, the case that came down 2 years before the Obergefell case. And then finally, even Obergefell itself in 2015, the same-sex marriage case, he wrote all of those opinions, as well as one more gay rights opinion, Lawrence v. Texas, and all of these opinions in one way or another tie back to the idea of animus. This will absolutely be one of his legacies.
Does it all get back to that the reason that their same-gender marriage was not legal before, or the reason that these voter initiatives are trying to undo discrimination protections for gays and lesbians is because there was a hostility and bigotry towards gays and lesbians?
Well, this is a really fascinating question, because if you ask the people who voted for the referendum, if you ask the congresspeople who voted for the Defense of Marriage Act, if you ask the state legislators who refused to authorize same-sex marriage, they would all say this is not about hating gays and lesbians. There are other public regarding legitimate reasons for the actions we took. And so what that really means is that inquiring into whether an action really is based in animus or not, that inquiry really requires a very careful look at a lot of objective factors that either suggest that, in fact, animus really was percolating under the surface or that it wasn't. But in most cases, a state legislator is not going to be so foolish as to get on the floor of the state house and say, the reason I'm voting for this law is because I hate gay people. They may have carried the day 30 years ago, maybe, but certainly not not more recently, and that makes the animus inquiry a much more nuanced one, a much more really interesting one in a lot of ways.
Hard to measure. I mean, how do you determine animus in a case or not?
No, it's a really great question. And in fact, one of the things the book does is it tries to explain how to measure or how to identify animus by reference to another equal protection concept called discriminatory intent. Without getting into a lot of details or a lot of weeds, the idea is that there are objective considerations that a judge can look at that will help her decide whether, in fact, despite whatever is said on the surface, despite whatever the legislature says or doesn't say on the state house floor, that, you know, in fact, animus really is infecting this decision. We get this idea as early as Romer, where Justice Kennedy goes through the legitimate possibilities for why Amendment 2 was ratified, and then says, well, those just don't make any sense. The only thing that must be left is animus. And it's that sort of analysis that he, in fact, in particular, developed, you know, in more detail throughout the course of the other animus opinions that he wrote. That's what I talk about in the book.
There must be legal debates between philosophical traditions about the use of animus.
Absolutely.
In this.
Absolutely. There are a number of scholars who do not like using the concept of animus because they argue, to shorthand a very complex argument, they argue that it inevitably tars with a subjectively evil brush, I guess is the way to put it, the intentions or motivations of the government defendants or the constituents who supported them. In other words, you can't use the label animus, they argue, without calling people wrong or immoral. And for that reason, these scholars attempt to sort of push away from animus. They try to find other theories to support, an evolving equality jurisprudence. I think animus is a useful concept. And again, in the book, I try to defend how one can find it without using that tarring brush of simply evil, bad people.
Again, William D. Ariza has been our guest. He's vice dean and professor of law at Brooklyn Law School, and he is the author of the book called Animus, A Short Introduction to Bias in the Law.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Nomi Prince, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Part 2, A Conversation. Nomi Prince is a former Wall Street executive turned whistleblower. She worked as a managing director at Goldman Sachs, a senior managing director at Bear Stearns, and was a senior strategist at Lehman Brothers, and an analyst at the Chase Manhattan Bank. Nomi Prince now is a writer, investigative journalist, and public speaker. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Forbes, The Guardian, and The Nation. She's the author of 6 books, among them the exposé, It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bonuses, Bailouts, and Backroom Deals, From Washington to Wall Street, and All the President's Bankers, a narrative about the relationship between presidents and key bankers over the past century. Her most recent 2018 book is Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Prince predicts that rising income inequality and an elite class bent on preserving its dominance, will cause a bigger collapse than the 2008 crisis. Nomi Prince was interviewed by Juliet Shore, professor of sociology at Boston College. Juliet Shore's research, writing, and teaching focus on the economy, environmental sustainability, women's issues, wealth inequality, and consumerism. Nomi Prince had been invited by the Santa Fe Lannan Foundation to give one of their prestigious lectures. You heard parts of her talk in the previous TUC radio program. After her talk, she shared the stage with Juliet Shore for a conversation. The date was January 24, 2018. Here's Juliet Shore's first question.
I wanted to back up a little bit from collusion and what's happened since the crash to talk about the context that existed before. Mm-hmm. And this brings me to all the president's bankers and mm-hmm. your argument there. So in that book, which, as I think I mentioned, it's a wonderful financial history starting in the very late 19th century, but basically 20th century, of the role of the banks and their relationship to the government. Basically, you are chronicling the amassing of power, particularly by these six large banks, and their ability to dictate to the government. That comment that I mentioned earlier, government by Goldman for Goldman. I mean, many people have argued it's the military-industrial complex that runs the country. Others see the power of Silicon Valley. Why do you think it's the banks? Why are they so important? And what are the consequences of their power?
First of all, that history is important to gain an understanding for the answer to that, because just 100 years before the crisis, in 1907, there was something called a panic in New York, and it was the equivalent of a financial crisis in New York. And at the time, there was no insured deposits. And some of the smaller banks were doing some very shady trading in copper with each other. They were trying to corner markets. They were trying to sort of, you know, buy it all up and then sort of squeeze the price up and then sort of make a lot of money and come out. People got word of it. Confidence got lost. And there were these massive panics throughout New York where people were basically being beaten back by policemen at the time to stay away from the doors of banks when they opened to get their money out and so forth. And so there was a real physical manifestation of fear in the country. And at the time, Teddy Roosevelt, who was the president, was concerned by this. And he had a friend named J.P. Morgan in New York, and he basically allowed J.P. Morgan to decide what should happen. And it was kind of the first history of a bailout in the United States. So the Treasury Department allocated at the time $25 million, not trillions, but, you know, it was a scale thing. And they said to J.P. Morgan, you know what, you decide basically where to give this around in the financial system in New York so that you just stop this thing from happening. And so J.P. Morgan got a bunch of his friends together in his library on Fifth Avenue, and he said, okay, how about we just give it to each other and you know, some of those banks were not particularly friends with anyway. And that's exactly what happened. But the result of that was some banks went under, like a bank called Knickerbocker Trust, which actually dealt with a lawsuit of lower middle class people in New York, went under. And everybody that had that J.P. Morgan sort of had an association with, all those banks, you know, did quite well. But it was promoted as a sort of like massive win for everybody. The New York Times had J.P. Morgan on a cover as being sort of the king of the country. And Teddy Roosevelt thanked him, and I, you know, all this kind of stuff. And that just started this sort of relationship of sort of abdicating the responsibility of looking at a financial crisis, even from that standpoint, from a strong president, and sort of giving that to the bankers or helping the bankers or helping a banker in particular. And the result of that was J.P. Morgan turned around and said, well, I don't know what's going to happen next time, because frankly, I don't even know the Treasury Department's going to have enough money to handle this. Like, he actually was concerned the Treasury Department wouldn't be there next time. And he was one of the people, and I chronicle this in the book, that actually created the philosophies and sponsored individuals to go to a place called Jekyll Island, which was a club that he was a member of in Georgia, off the coast of Georgia, and get together and sort of manifest what became the Federal Reserve. And the reason for that was to have an area in Washington outside of the Treasury Department that could help banks help themselves in a crisis. And that's kind of what I was talking about today. But why that's important, it also manifested a relationship a personal, a very personal relationship, the kind of which lasted for decades, and through the crash of 1929. So now you have a Fed that was created at the end of 1913, started in 1914. You have World War I happen. You have sort of a collaboration between the Morgan Bank and Chase and other major banks at this time with the government through war and through, you know, a changing world. And so you keep relationships going. You're telegraphing presidents during, you know, Wilson during wartime and so forth. And it gets tighter and tighter. And then the 1929 crash happens after an isolationist policy and after a lot of deregulation on Wall Street, because they're all friends. They'd all help, you know, the U.S. in the war and so forth. And then you have, like, Goldman Sachs come up. You have Sidney Weinberg, who was the head of Goldman Sachs at the time. There's a crash going on. Goldman's losing all his credibility and money in this crash. So he decides, how do I get my credibility back? Oh, I know. I'll help run FDR. And that's what he did. He helped raise money for FDR's campaign. Now, we subsequently know FDR as a president who did, you know, many progressive things, the New Deal, FDIC insurance, Glass-Steagall was passed under him and so forth. But he was run by a group of bankers as well. And the reciprocation for that was Sidney Weinberg got a sort of seat on the business council for FDR. And so even though all these other things were going on, these relationships, he was just one of many bankers, but a major one who then had a relationship with five presidents in various advisory capacities while he was running Goldman. So a lot of this stuff has very strong historical ties. And so the difference today in the last sort of two decades is that there's been this complete dislocation between these bankers actually also getting involved in trying to help the real economy or the country in war times, you know, so the military-industrial element of it, and just caring about their own pockets. And that's where it's become more dangerous and these crises have become more prevalent, and their role in Washington. Like, I'll go in and I'll talk to a congressperson and I'll walk out and there'll be, like, you know, 12 people coming in from Morgan Stanley, and it's like me leaving. It's like, hey, guys, you know, and so the numbers are very imbalanced, and those relationships have been historical, but now they're really about preserving fully themselves, as opposed to having some sort of a interaction with the government and in helping sort of a broader population. Like, bankers helped Eisenhower pass the acts that created our highways. And actually Weinberg was involved in that. The old head of Chase was involved in that. But that was a situation where they had a benefit, the country had a benefit, and workers had a benefit, and the economy had a benefit. So it was something that was still going on during the military-industrial complex period, during Eisenhower's time. I mean, a positive way, but it's not like that at all anymore.
So this question of bailouts and sort of what to do in financial crises and sort of thinking about that 1907 in relationship to the 2008, if we think back to what was going on at the time in 2008, you know, first with Bush and then Obama, basically they took the view that bailing out the banks would be good for the public. And there was really almost no imagination or possibility about another way, I would say. Of course, there was a little bit of talk about nationalizing the banks, but it turned out that was, you know, really, you know, very little. And I think Obama didn't have much stomach for doing much out of that norm, which, as you say, is already a century old. So let me just play devil's advocate for a second and say, yeah, they bailed out the banks, but we've had 10 years of almost now, 10 years of growth. Has quantitative easing really been so terrible? Was there another path at that time? I mean, what else could have happened?
Right, so I actually have a number in It Takes a Pillage. The time of the crisis, there was $14 trillion worth of toxic assets that had been created by our banks, which was the majority of what there were in the world at the time. And when I say toxic, ones that were somehow associated with the mortgage market. So not ones that they had in other forms of any securities that weren't related. And only $0.5 trillion of actual subprime mortgages or in them. So just imagine you're making a cherry pie, but you want to sort of skimp on cherries. And so, you take some cherries and then, like, you mix them with a lot of water and then, like, you put that in the pie. And so it sort of looks like cherry pie, but really the sort of factor of cherries to stuff that looks like cherries is low. So that's kind of what happened with these subprime mortgages. There was only about $500 billion that were involved in what brought down the system. Had the policy been, just for example, to make the mortgages whole, to basically say to the subprime mortgage borrowers who were underwater, we're going to either, you know, extend to forever your loan, or we're going to give you a really deep discount, or we're going to basically readjust it and sort of repay the rest of it so that you can A, stay in your house and B, not have to incur financial hardship on the other side, and et cetera, that the path to doing that by financial engineering would have actually made those $14 trillion worth of assets have value. So it would have done two things. It would have helped all of the mortgage borrowers, and it would have meant that these interest payments that were coming into these assets would keep coming in because they would be structured accordingly, which would mean that in a sort of perverse but useful sense, these assets would have continued to have value, and they wouldn't have tanked the whole system, because one of the other things that tanked the whole system was that a lot of places were borrowing money to buy these assets, too. So it wasn't just about the $14 trillion of toxic assets that were built upon $500 billion of subprime mortgages. It was about Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, you know, a small town in Norway, you know, borrowing money in order to buy them. And so that money also couldn't be repaid because the expectation was they were buying these assets and would get interest on them, and so they would be getting something from them. But when they stop getting anything from them, they still have to pay the money they borrowed to buy them. And so that was one of the reasons the system collapsed around these assets. So you could have fixed the entire thing, in my opinion, with $500 billion, which would, I mean, the whole world would have been totally different, right? I mean, then you could have had, you basically could have had a situation where all of this decade of cheap money and sort of all the money going into the stock market and all this debt that's been created, our debt to GDP level in this country is over 100%. You know, in Japan, it's over 200%. There's a significant amount of borrowing from the future and hoping it'll all be okay that's sustaining, you know, the sort of economies or the payments for running the economy of all these countries. You would, I believe, not have had any of that. But I mean, I don't know. It's just my, yeah. That's just the math of it.
But I mean, I think one of the other issues is that fiscal policy has been so delegitimized by conservatives that the government really has had to rely so much more heavily on monetary policy because, you know, there was a small and much too small fiscal stimulus at the beginning of the crash, and then the possibility for any more fiscal stimulus went away. And that's through a fiscal stimulus, we would not have had to, you know, the problem that you identified, which is giving the money to the banks, and then they're not doing with it what we think they should be, which is investing in infrastructure or other social investments or small businesses or any good things that need to be happening. With fiscal policy, you can directly do that, but it got taken off the table. Part of why we're in the situation that we're in of so much, as you call it, conjured money, is because the sort of more appropriate policy for dealing with a crash, particularly a demand crash, which is what happens after a financial crisis, was off the table. Anyway. At the end of All the President's Bankers, you said, quote, it no longer matters who sits in the White House. After a year of Trump. not the mean part of it. Do you feel that way? But the serious part of it is Trump in the same structural position with respect to the financial sector that you argued, I think quite rightly, Obama, the Bushes, Clinton, et cetera, have been? Or is something different with Trump?
So, just financially. Obviously, when he campaigned, one of the things that he said was that he would not be beholden to Wall Street. And then he went and he put in a whole bunch of people from Goldman Sachs into positions of power, including Steve Mnuchin into the Treasury Secretary position. So what he did by doing that is prove that it, from that respect, the people that are sort of running financial policy in the country are the same people. The problem that is now happening, though, is that all those people are major deregulation advocates. And so that's where it can get worse. One of the things that was in the Republican platform and in the Democratic platform was to reinstate Glass-Steagall. And actually, the wording in the Republican platform was very even more specific than it was in the Democratic platform, which is that they specifically were going to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933. And the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, it's a very short act, and it basically separates into individual institutions with completely separate boards of directors and completely different capital sources, commercial banking, so deposits and savings and loans from any type of speculative banking, creating securities, mergers and acquisitions, any type of more complex operations. That was the point of it. So Steve Mnuchin, who's running the Treasury Department, very quickly told Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders over a course of Senate hearings and just publicly that that's not what they meant. I was actually in a meeting when he first said that to Elizabeth Warren. I was in Washington. I was actually meeting with one of the senior people on the Finance Committee, who was a Republican, and he was also one of the members of the Republican National Committee. So I was actually in RNC headquarters meeting with him, and he came in and he was very respectful. He's like, "So, what is our policy?" And the reason he asked me that was because in Trump's campaigning and in the RNC, it was very clear that the policy would be, or at least what was said it would be, was to reinstate Glass-Steagall. And all of a sudden, I was there that day when Steve Mnuchin is basically telling Elizabeth Warren that's not what they meant. And he was legitimately confused by this. And he said, "What do you think Trump wants to do?" And I'm like, "He's your guy. I just think that if you look at, again, overall stability, there was a reason that was put in the platform. There was a reason that people feel that the banks got a far better deal than they did throughout the country and whoever you voted for. And there is a situation where the Fed and therefore the government is on the hook for potentially more money if this all goes even more wrong in the future. And there's a reason to assume it will because things haven't been fixed from the last time." And that's what I said in the end of Other People's Money, the first book I wrote in 2004, I wrote about how derivatives would be a major problem, and in fact, credit derivatives and CDOs, which were part of the toxic asset thing, and they were because they weren't regulated products, and the banking system had been deregulated as per Glass-Steagall being decimated in 1999. So Trump coming in is not doing anything different except that some of his, in that respect, except that some, he's not pushing what was on the policy, like not once. And on that policy. And his people are very deregulatory. The fellow's coming in to run the Fed, he's a former private equity guy. He's not really into regulating the financial system. In fact, he's been very clear about how the Fed should be positioned more to promote deregulation of the financial system, which was exactly what Alan Greenspan did when he helped to create a situation where banks could trade more derivatives with the capital of people's deposits on their books to begin with, and that didn't work out really well. So a lot of the people there, the head of the SEC, the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Board, who's also still the OMB director Mulvaney thought that, quote, it is a joke and doesn't want it and asked for no funding for it this year. So it's actually worse by the people who he's brought in, but it's not different from the standpoint of having this allegiance to Wall Street.
Yeah.
You're listening to an interview of former Wall Street executive Nomi Prinz by Julia Chore. For the full audio or video, go to the website of the Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe and search for Nomi Prinz. Nomi, last name, Prins.
I spend a lot of my time working on and worrying about climate change. And, in that world, the bad guys are the Kochs and Exxon and BP and Shell and their denier think tanks and so forth. I'm curious about, of course, there's been a fair amount of attention lately to banks funding pipelines, but just in terms of your research and experience, how do you see the connections between the fossil fuel industry and the climate denier, the Kochs and their networks and so forth, and Wall Street?
So kind of like how Wall Street doesn't care about partisanship, it doesn't really care about what side of the climate change arguments it's on. And in fact, it will, you know, banks will absolutely try to fund a pipeline the same day they'll open up a green investment account. So, for example, you know, Goldman was advocating for the last couple of years, as were some other major banks, you know, these new investment creations where green energy was a part of it, and they were actually investing quite heavily and getting private equity money to invest quite heavily in solar and in wind and in other types of cleaner energy and sustainable energy projects. At the same time, their largest clients continue to be Exxon and BP and so forth. So from the standpoint of, and Lloyd Blankfein was advocating pro-climate change, and when Trump got the U.S. out of the Paris Accords, I think one of the major bankers actually thought that was a bad idea, or at least the banks were positioned to sort of make money out of it by investing in clean on the other side in Europe. So they don't care from that standpoint. They will figure out a way to make money on both sides of that.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Because their direct intention is to create suffering of people. What they want is that people not be able to buy medicine or food and then pressure their government so the government comes down. In short, they're immoral. They prevent the people of a country from buying food and medicine.
That's the voice of Venezuelan sociologist Maria Paez. On this week's show, we speak to Maria about the recent Venezuelan elections and many of the mistruths and misinformation we've been receiving in our mainstream media. So stay tuned.
I'm very privileged this morning to be joined by sociologist Dr. Maria Paez. Welcome to our show, Maria.
Thank you very much for having me, Sylvia.
Now, there are many exciting things in the world and many frightening things at the moment. Some of the exciting things are the results in the elections in Venezuela. And I'd like to begin by talking about the significance of this election process and the results.
Thank you. Well, the first thing I'd like to say about the elections in Venezuela, that Jimmy Carter famously said that the electoral process in Venezuela was the best in the world because it's practically fraud-proof. You get you have three things. You have the fingerprint, you have a piece of paper, and you have the electronics. So it is a great process. It was carried out in order and transparency. And this election in particular was a great victory for the Venezuelan people, who have withstood all kinds of pressures and threats to stop them from voting. The opposition, the United States, the Organization of American States, they all demanded elections last year. And the government kept on saying, well, they're planned for December of 2018. No, they want it now. In the table, they were negotiating with the opposition. They agreed, all right, you want them beforehand. And they agreed that it would be first April and then May. And then, having agreed on this election, before the elections were started, they decided that they weren't going to participate in the election. That, this, of course, was under the order of the Americans. Tillerson called up and said to them, don't sign this, don't participate in the election. So you have a crazy situation in which these people who go on and on about democracy all of a sudden don't want the elections which they had demanded, and then went on a campaign telling the people not to vote. Well, they lost. This was a great victory for the Venezuelan people. It's a people that have political savvy. They have consciousness of their country, of their class struggle, of the geopolitical chess that powerful countries are playing with Venezuela. Basically, what they want is the oil. So 6 million people voted for President Maduro. And these are the people who are poor and working class, the ones who are suffering because of the Canadian, the American, and the European sanctions. But they recognize who is really on their side, which is President Maduro, who leads the Bolivarian Revolution.
It's intriguing that, you know, in the 21st century, when we speak of post-colonial era, there are many who thought that the European Union would have been a counterbalance to the superpower that still exists, like the U.S. It was astounding to hear, and almost sinister, that the European Parliament on May 3rd passed a resolution with 492 people in favor and 87 against, and there was only 77 abstentions, demanding that Venezuela suspend the presidential election stated for May 20th. While it has been well documented that, you know, this country has held more democratic processes in terms of the elections in the in the last 19 years, you know, there's been 23 elections that have occurred in Venezuela, and they have a robust presence of domestic and international observers who have hailed this process as very democratic. Why is it such a threat to the U.S., and why is the European Union falling behind this undemocratic demands from the President Trump administration?
Well, you know, the EU has acted since 1945 as vassals of the United States. They have continuously followed the United States in all of their policies, practically. But right now, it's pretty awful because they are following the most erratic president of the United States, and they are doing something which is a crime against humanity, because the sanctions of the EU, of the USA, and of Canada violate international law. They're against the charters of the UN. They're against the charter of the OAS. They're against the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights. They're against the International Covenant of Economic, Civil, and Cultural Rights. And the reason they are a crime against humanity, because their direct intention is to create suffering of people. What they want is the people not be able to buy medicine and food, and then pressure their government so the government comes down. In short, they're immoral. They prevent the people of a country from buying food and medicine. And the EU, instead of being a wise counterpoint to the USA, they have backed these unjust sanctions against Venezuela, a country that has never done them any harm, and they are acting in order to get on the good side of this erratic Trump, believing that he actually has a good side. And, of course, Canada's doing the same thing. Canada, wants, above all, to save NAFTA. And so these countries, the EU and Canada, throw Venezuela under the bus because, after all, they don't care about Venezuela. Venezuela isn't important to Canada. Venezuela isn't important to the EU. So they say, well, let's give this little tidbit to Trump, and he'll see, you know, what good friends we are. And so they throw Venezuela under the bus. And this is a very unprincipled situation, because when you go against international law, you are affecting all the countries. This international law is the only thing that can possibly maintain and guarantee peace in the world. And they are trashing it, left, right, and center. This is very serious indeed.
Not only that, that a country should have a right to conduct elections, and that other countries should not have the right to impede those elections from taking place, but also that there is so much, there is now a talk from the European Union saying that they do not accept the elections, and, you know, singing from the choir of the Trump administration, because there are no guarantees, without specifying what they mean by that, you know. And they ask for a return to the constitutional order without allusion of, you know, or attempting to know what the Venezuelan laws and constitution are. So can we talk a little bit about the significance of the Bolivarian Revolution in redefining and creating perhaps a new vision of what democracy could look like? And because perhaps I think that's the key to this discussion. In an era of austerity, in an era where everyone is being asked to do with less, Venezuela, since the collapse of the economy, you know, since the economic collapse in 2008, has been investing in their population. And so can we talk about that revolution and what it has meant in contrast to the policies that other countries have taken?
Well, the first thing I want to address is the fact that the Venezuelan Bolivarian Revolution has been the one to enshrine human rights in not only in the Constitution, but in the laws that it has enacted and in the actual working of the government. We've never had this before in Venezuela. In Venezuela before, we had a government that governed almost 2 years with guarantees suspended. That means there were no rights for civilians at all. And no matter what happened, they would suspend your rights. This hasn't happened in Venezuela. Even in the midst of the terrible opposition violence of 2014 and 2017, never once did the government suspend the democratic rights. Now, why is this? Because the truth is that it is the left-wing governments of Latin America who are the ones who have upheld democratic and human rights. Remember, it's been left-wingers who have had the ones who suffered from being killed, being tortured, being thrown out during the Plan Condor. 60,000 reformists, union leaders, teachers, politicians of the left were killed in Latin America. This was during the Cold War. So the truth is that it's the left-wing governments that repeatedly restore human rights and protect democracy in the region. Just take a look. The right-wing governments that are right now in power are unable to get the popular vote. They come to power through corruption, like Peru, Colombia, and Panama, through fraud, like Mexico twice, coup d'etat, Honduras, and with paramilitary and legal coups, deformation of institutions. They are legal coups, and this happened in Brazil and in Paraguay. And in Macri and Ecuador, under Moreno, they were elected, but one would say by masking their real intentions, by lying during their elections. So we're going to see that the people are going to realize that those who are on their side are those who are the popular progressive governments and parties. We're going to see a new red tide sooner rather than later, because once people have tasted sovereignty, they're not likely to turn back. The Venezuelan Bolivarian Revolution, you know, they say that Maduro is a dictator. Well, this dictator has just built 2 million public housing. Now, no country in the world has done this, and it's done this in the last 2-3 years. 2 million public housing, and I've seen those public housing. I've been inside of them, and they are marvelous. Some are little houses, and some are in buildings. You know, in the urban areas, they're buildings, and they are places where you wouldn't be sorry to be living in. They're beautiful. They have lovely windows, or the air coming in. They're just marvelous places. So you have a government that, in the midst of this terrible economic situation, is still building houses for its people. And whereas in Europe, in Spain, and in Greece, where people are throwing themselves out of balconies because they can't get the food, in Venezuela, there isn't any kind of famine because the government has said, whatever money we have, we are going to make sure that the people have what they need. And so there's this system of distributing to people the basic bread basket, you know, the basket with the important products that they need. And this is all over the country that this has been done. So the government is protecting the people. But the sanctions are worrisome because the government can't buy some of the food. The government can't buy some of the medicines, you see, because these companies won't accept Venezuelan currency, so much so that even the money that is owed to Venezuela from selling their petroleum to the United States, it cannot get those assets. Those people can't pay back to Venezuela. So this is a very serious situation, but Venezuela has done something really creative, and that is it established a cryptocurrency called the petro, which is a cryptocurrency. No one knows who you are or where you are, and you can pay with it. But the difference with the Venezuelan petro is that it is the only cryptocurrency in the world that is backed by a government. It is backed by the petroleum and the ore wealth of Venezuela. Each cryptocurrency is equivalent to one barrel of oil.
I want to talk a little bit more about the significance of a government who is committed to these people. As you point out, the 2 million homes are a beautiful example when we think about Canada, for instance, where our homelessness is increasing, where we have seen no projects to increase affordable housing. And you know, the whole idea that another government should have a say in how an election is conducted or who gets to participate. One of the criticisms against the election were that the opposition leaders abstain from participating. Can we talk about their relationship of this so-called abstention and the now call for humanitarian aid, what they're calling humanitarian aid?
Yes. Well, first of all, the main coalition that said that they weren't going to participate, and so they were urging all the others. But three courageous leaders of the opposition said, no, this is crazy. We will participate. So we had three reputable leaders of the opposition who stood for election, and they were pressured not only by that opposition coalition, they were pressured directly by the Americans, who told them, no, you've got to drop out. And to their credit, those opposition leaders who are not at all identified with the violent section of the opposition, like the coalition is, they stood their ground, and the nearest one got 21%, and the other one got about 10%. But they did a courageous thing, and they ran for election. And you know, many people would have voted for them if the others had not been out there saying we shouldn't vote. So it was sheer, utterly political stupidity on the part of the opposition of doing this.
I would add that was political theater, because on one hand, they've been clamoring for elections.
Yes.
On the other one, they stepped down, proposing that there's some kind of impediment that's not allowing them to run. So I want to talk about the arrest and incarceration of Leopoldo López. That I think is a very important case to talk about, and the reasons why this person has been trial, has had a fair trial, and why this person was incarcerated. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the incident that led to the arrest of Leopoldo López.
Okay, so there are two important political people who are in jail. One is Leopoldo López, who is the one most known, and there's another one, Ledesma. Both went to trial, and both in a trial in which they had the best lawyers in the world, because they're very rich people. They were found guilty. Now, let's talk about Leopoldo López. Leopoldo López is a lightweight. He has no following in Venezuela, practically none, but he has a following outside the country because he was a graduate of Harvard and he has all this American sort of backing. This young man is the son of two of Venezuela's most traditional and most rich families in there. It's super rich, okay? So he was the one who invented the salida, which meant let's go out on the street and burn and kill how many people we want in 2014. And he was caught on camera. He just went right on camera, but you know, it was filmed, telling people to go out there and do violence. And when he did this, 46 people were killed. They put wires across the street, and several people on their motorcycles had their heads cut off. They had people shot to death. They did burnings. They did all kinds of absolutely horrible things. So this man went to trial, a trial that lasted months, with the best lawyers that money could buy. But what can you do against a television camera that is showing your words and your deeds? So this is why he's in jail. He was given 13 years. And by the way, the victims of his violence objected to that and thought that he should be in there much longer than 13 years. Now, there's something very important. Maduro won the elections, huh? And one of the first things he did the very next day, he said, well, now we're going to have a process of reconciliation. And one of the things he did was he met with the industrialists, he met with the bankers, but he also gave an amnesty to those who had been placed in jail due to violence in these protests, but not if they had been if they had gone to trial and been convicted of murder. So the murderers were not included, but a whole group of people, I think there must have been about 20 of them, there was a meeting with them, and their guarantee was given by the opposition governors. There's about three or four governors of the states of Venezuela who are of opposition. And Maduro brought them in, and these people were the guarantees that if he allows these men out, that they will not do any violence and their opposition will be democratic. Now, this was greatly supported by the people. It was, you know, everyone thought this was a very good thing that he did. And it's really good that these opposition governors backed the government in this and said, yes, we will watch over these people so that they do not do any violence. This was a tremendous thing that's never been done in Venezuela before. I have to say this because this is true. In Canada, if you take a brick and you throw it through someone's window, and if you are in a demonstration and you beat up someone else, you will be in jail. Lickety split, okay? There will be no mercy for you. And this is what happened in Venezuela, that a lot of these people were allowed to continue with this violence because we had an attorney general who was in fact a spy, who was in fact put there by the Americans and kept on letting these people go. So when Maduro put these people in jail, it was to stop the violence on the street of innocent bystanders. The people they killed were like people walking down the street. It was just an awful thing. But by doing this reconciliation, he has started a new period in Venezuela of great stability, because he's talked to the bankers, he's talked to the industrial. By the way, these industrials and these bankers, you should have seen them sort of fawning over Maduro. They realize all of a sudden, hey, this is going to be the government. This is going to be the president for the next 6 years, and they better stop their conspiration against the government. And, of course, this business of the amnesty to those who did violence but didn't kill anyone.
And that is such a contrast to the U.S., where more than 3,500 people are in jail for nonviolent crimes doing life, you know, where you have Kim Kardashian actually interceding for a 63-year-old woman who had served more than 23 years in jail, you know, for a nonviolent offense. So it's to me, it's important to highlight these issues, because the whole call for humanitarian action usually in Latin America can be translated to invasion. How is the government of Venezuela preparing for what seems to be, you know, continuous aggression from the U.S. and countervailing, I guess, the assaults that they're facing economically and politically?
Well, I will say that Venezuela is not asking for any special, you know, treatment. Just follow the law, the international law. Now, it's not likely that the U.S. is going to invade Venezuela. The theater that they're putting out is they can't say that Venezuela has weapons of mass destruction, because the world would be laughing at it. It doesn't have anything related to that. But they're trying to say that there's a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. And because of this crisis, they're trying to get an international sort of group to go in there and topple the government. This is what this Lima group is all about. What is really scary is that is the Colombian army. The United States is not likely to send their troops in. They're likely to use the Colombian army, which is substantially, several times bigger than the size of the Venezuelan army. And Colombia's experience in war, because it's been battling, you know, the guerrillas for 50 years. But more than that, it's got 7 U.S. bases in Colombia, and they just joined NATO. This is Colombia, the largest provider of drugs to the United States and the largest recipient of U.S. aid. And I don't think these are a coincidence. But, however, it's a demoralized army identified with paramilitary crimes and civilian massacres. It doesn't have a bit of the morale that the Venezuelan army is. Venezuela's army is the army of Bolivar, and the army has an enormous morale. And it's backed by an organized, inspired, and proud people who will defend Venezuela. So Venezuela also has the backing of many countries in the world. The Caribbean, some of the Caribbean nations have been absolutely heroic in defending Venezuela, of course, including Cuba. Russia and China have warned the United States to lay off Venezuela because they have substantial investments there. So they have cautioned them about that. Now, the other thing that Venezuela has done is the cryptocurrency. It has, since you can't use the Venezuelan currency because they won't allow to accept it, they've got a cryptocurrency which is very unique in the world, because it's the only cryptocurrency that is backed by a government, and it's backed by the Venezuelan petroleum and gold. So that is helping a lot. And more than that, I think that the economic situation will succeed. It's a blockade, just like they have done to Cuba for 50 years. But unlike Cuba, that when the blockade started, the only asset that Cuba had was sugarcane. They were very poor island. It's not the situation now. They have proven, the Cubans have shown their determination, their survival, their thriving despite the blockade. And I think that looking at that example and having the utter support of Cuba, Venezuela, which is an immensely rich country in terms of natural resources, it will be able to come through with this. And I do hope that the EU, and I hope that Canada, just picks itself off the mud and shows some sort of, backbone and stop this harassment of Venezuela, which I attribute almost absolutely to this woman Freeland, who is a rabid anti-socialist, you know, in an old-fashioned way, which is really quite sad. And she has her actions at the OEF have filled me with utter embarrassment for Canada. So I hope that she gets kicked out of the cabinet, because I think that Pierre Trudeau would be turning in his grave to see what his son is doing with respect to Canada and Latin America. You remember that Pierre Trudeau, in the middle of this fierce Cold War, maintained an independent Canadian foreign policy and refused the pressure of the United States and maintained good relationships with Cuba and China. Unfortunately, the son, I think, doesn't even know this.
Thank you for being with us today, and thank you for the work you do. How can people access your work?
Our webpage, and you will find there what our email address is. So that's the Canadian, Latin American, and Caribbean Policy Center. I look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you, Sylvia. Thank you very, very much.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.